Happy New Year, and welcome to DC Special Cast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at that time. Today, I am joined by one of the co-hosts of the fantastic Earth 2 podcast, Peter Watson. Hey, Peter, how you doing today? Feeling villainous?
I'm feeling exceptionally villainous, Paul. We've literally just finished recording some issues of Secret Society of Supervillains. So, yes, I'm feeling especially notorious, some would say.
That's awesome. Well, Peter, thanks for being on. For those people who aren't familiar with you and your background, can you tell me like how you got into U.S. comics or your specific areas of interest, stuff like that? Tell me your secret origin.
Secret origin. Yeah, in the UK, when I was a boy growing up, most of the comics we got were British weekly comics, things like the Beano and the Dandy. They were just like your newspaper strips, pretty much. And they were all aimed firmly at kids. But also, occasionally, you would see the odd spinner rack in like the local corner shop. Mm-hmm. And I have very, very vivid memories of in the local shop seeing such comics as that Superman issue with Mr. McShane Pertlick with the Daily Planet turning into actual papers.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
That one, yeah. Uh-huh. Also, there was The Death of Mr. Terrific, the first part of that. I remember buying that at the time, one of my earliest DC comics as well. It was mostly DC that we had. You still got Marvel comics, American ones, but to be honest, a lot of the Marvel stuff was reprinted for the British market, right, and was done in various different formats. They usually had to kind of cut and paste to make it fit the new different size and sometimes add extra artwork or sometimes condense things. But yeah, for the most part, you would have like strange mashups like Conan and the Avengers in one comic together. It's like, they don't really go, but okay, fair enough. So that was the UK versions, but I much preferred the American format. Fortunately, as I said, my local comic shop had them. Well, sorry, my local newsagent had them. And I always used to ask my gran when I was around seeing my gran if I could get 15p for a DC. Is what I would always ask for, because that's how much they were here. Oh, those good old days.
Yeah, 15 I know, pence. Really.
So yeah, so basically, that was me when I was young. And then when I was a teenager, I discovered my first comic shop. And that was the legendary AKA Books and Comics in Glasgow, which really was a hub for a lot of the Glasgow creators. Grant Morrison used to hang around there. Alan Grant used to pop in from time to time. Mark Miller was there as well. There's lots of the Glasgow creative scene who always hung about there.
And you?
Yeah. And me, yeah. So, yes. So yeah, and that just opened my eyes to all these amazing back issues. It was a really small shop at the time, but it seemed huge compared to anything I'd ever seen before. And I've kind of been a comic book junkie ever since. I always say that if you cut me, then basically I'd bleed in four colours. So yes, I've been obsessed ever since. So there we are.
Now, I know when I've spoken to other people from the UK, the ones that were giant size, dollar comics, specials, annuals, they were less, before the comic shops when you started to get, but yeah, they were less likely to show up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they were less prevalent then, but you did still see them from time to time. I remember being really annoyed that I could never find a copy of Justice League of America issue 200.
Oh, that's a bad one to miss too.
I know. It's like eventually I found one. I think they actually got that in AKA Books and Comics, I think. But yeah, so some of the larger formats and things like the annuals, you didn't see them as often, because right, I think the shops, the newsagents and like small shops that used to stock them kind of did them by how much they cost. To keep things simple, they just put in the stuff that all cost the same. Yeah. And obviously, the larger format ones or thicker comics, they right, were a bit more expensive.
Right.
So to keep their accounting simple, they just got in what they, what all the same things. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that secret origin. But before we go much farther, I'd like to take a minute to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Special Cast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So, Peter, I know InStock Trades does not deliver to the UK, but Do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
I most certainly do. As I said earlier, I am a total comic book obsessive, and I work for Forbidden Planet in Glasgow. And I always like to support our local artists. So I'm going to recommend a book by an up-and-comer called Frank Quitely, written by another up-and-comer called Grant Morrison. So I'd like to recommend All-Star Superman because it's phenomenal. Frank Quitely, or Vin as we call him because he's one of the regulars in the shop, he actually did a lot of design stuff for Forbidden Planet in Glasgow. And basically, as you walk in, there's a giant mural of Superman, his Superman flying in, coming
Wow.
right at you. It is beautiful. It is huge. And it's from straight out of All-Star Superman.
You have to send me a picture of that. I'll
Oh,
put it in
yeah.
the notes for our
I
listeners.
certainly shall, yeah. Now, it's available in several formats. All of them are available from in-stock trades. If you want the compact format, you can get that. They're all 44% off. If you wanted the compact format of it, an excellent deal. It should have been $9.99, but that would only be $5.59. But no one wants to see Frank Quitely's artwork in that size, so that's a bit silly. You can get it in the standard paperback, which was $29.99, but that's now $16.79. Or you could go higher up and get the deluxe edition hardcover, which was $34.99 and is now $19.59. But if you really want to treat yourself, and this is what I've got, get the absolute edition because it is beautiful, it is glorious, and it's the best format to get it in. That should have been $125, but it's only $70, 44% off, $55 off.
That's pretty good.
Amazing.
And that's the format I have too.
Yes, good man.
The Absolutes editions are great.
Oh, they're the best. Yeah.
Well, my recommendation is a little different, but it is keeping with the theme of villains for the episode. And I'm going to recommend the Thunderbolts Epic Collection, Volume 1, Justice Like Lightning by Kurt Busiek and Mark Bagley, of course. So this was the first story arc, Thunderbolts 1 to 12. Bought Thunderbolts number 1, although I started falling off of Marvel by the mid-90s. I bought Thunderbolts number 1, and then it turned out that they were villains at the end. Spoiler alert for a 30-year-old comic. But this one's great. This one is full color, 520 pages, generally $39.99. You can get it 40% off. So please check out in stock trades. Today, you've probably gathered, we are covering DC Special number 14, entitled Wanted, the World's Most Dangerous Villains. It had a cover date of September, October 1971, and was on sale July 1st, 1971. So right in the middle of the summer. It was 25-cent comic, which would have been 12p. Or no,
7.5 pence, I believe.
yeah, back then it was a different.
I do have a copy here, and it does have a Thorpe and Porter stamp on it, which is what they used to do. And it's got 7.5 pence, it
Seven and a
was.
half
So.
pence. A 48-pager edited, of course, by the legendary E. Nelson Bridwell. So I'll start off with Wayne's Special Investments. In the US, you can get a copy of this for $5 to $10. But I did see somebody trying to sell a graded 9.4 copy for
All right.
$130. Now, I love the Murphy Anderson cover here, which we'll talk about in a minute, but I wouldn't pay
Yeah.
that kind of money for this book. This is a fun book to read and have as part of my, complete DC Special collection, but I wouldn't pay $130 for this book. So, Peter, it
No.
sounds like you do have a physical copy. Tell me how you got yours.
Well, this is a ridiculous story, but I've bought one years ago at a Comic Mart, and in preparation for today, I dug it out and was had it aside all intentions of reading it before we started. That's great. And then I went to look for it last week, and could I find it? No. I put it in a very, very safe place. I think one of my cats might have batted it off of somewhere. I could not find it anywhere.
Oh no.
So I did what any sane person would do after tearing the house apart. I ordered another copy from eBay. And I kid you not, it literally arrived half an hour before we started recording.
Oh no.
I can show you the card device that arrived in. It's yeah, it
Oh
literally arrived half an hour before we started. So
no.
I've not had this copy for very long. I'm holding it up now for the benefit of your YouTube viewers. I had my other copy for about 30 years, I think. I do remember buying it at a Comic Mart in Glasgow in the early 90s, I think it was. Fun times. So
Yeah.
yes, there we go.
That's great. For our listeners, this issue is not on DC Universe Infinite, but there are three different stories, so I'll mention how else you might be able to read the stories when we get there. So Peter, when you went through the list when I invited you on the show, you selected this particular issue. Any particular reason why? Like, why did you say, "Oh, I want to do this comic?"
Well, as I said, when I found AK Books and Comics, I became a confirmed comic book junkie. And one of the first things you do when you're really embracing the history of comics is to find out as much as you can about all the characters and about all the creators, and about you just want to immerse yourself in this amazing world. And of course, back then, the late 80s, there weren't really any graphic novels. Mm-hmm. There was no internet. There was nothing really to tell you. Occasionally, you'd get reprints and backups. And then I discovered an issue in the back issues of a series called Wanted. And I thought, whoa, what's this? This has got Golden Age stories in it. Golden Age comics you do not see at all in the UK, because it wasn't until really the late 50s, early 60s that any kind of distribution came over. It would be ones that would actually have to come over, specifically orders from the States beforehand, before they were actually properly distributed here.
Gotcha.
So you would never see Golden Age stories. It was amazing seeing these issues. And also, it featured the bad guys. It highlighted the bad guys, highlighted the best of the bad guys. And bad guys have all the fun. So I've always enjoyed a good bad guy. As I said, Wanted was a great series. And then I discovered that as well as the Wanted series, there were two DC specials. And that's why I picked this one.
Well, that's a good segue, because this particular issue is the second comic to carry the banner of Wanted, the world's most dangerous villains. And so I thought I'd do a brief little history, because we love our history and stuff on this show. I had a couple issues of Wanted when I was a kid. At one point I went back and collected them all, but I've been downsizing my collection, saved all my DC specials, but I did sell my Wanteds, but not these. Anyway, the first thing that carried the banner was DC Special number 8, which was published a year earlier in 1970. And then this one came out in 71. So they must have sold well enough for DC to commission a regular series that started in 72. And all of them and subsequent ongoing series were curated and edited by E. Nelson Bridwell. So the ongoing title that you mentioned ran for 9 bi-monthly issues from 72 to 73. It was an anthology title that spotlighted the villains and sometimes, but not always, ran stories about the origins, similar to today. We got the first appearance of Heatwave, but the other stories are not origins. The similar book, Secret Origins, was another all-reprint title, but one that had a little more leeway for Bridwell to select the stories. So the result was a pretty unusual title that gave readers at the time access to Gold and Silver Age stories that they generally couldn't have read otherwise, which is kind of what you're talking about. For example, the first issue had 3 stories and spotlighted Signal Man, which is my podcast partner Sean's favorite, The Clock King versus Green Arrow.
Also excellent.
And The Puppet Master. No, not that one. And from Green Lantern number 1. So if you didn't have Green Lantern number 1, you get to hear that. The title also reprinted varied stories such as a Joker-Penguin team-up to the Man in the Iron Mask battling Doll Man. Fantastic. So it would be a fun series to do a podcast on at some point.
Yeah, we did an issue of Wanted, or at least a couple of stories for it on Earth 2, which is great fun. A Johnny Quick story where he fought Dr. Clever.
Yes, I listened to that one.
And Our Man fighting Dr. Glisten. Yeah, a Doctor special that was.
Back in 2020, DC did publish a hardcover edition which had all 9 issues and included an extra 10th issue that I don't think was actually planned in the 70s, but was done in the spirit of the original run and added to the hardcover. Sadly, the 2 special issues were not included in the hardcover, which I do have, and it's fabulous. I don't know why they did it that way, like why they didn't include these 2. But despite that, I do have the book, as I mentioned. It's fabulous. A collection of bunch of reprint comics is a strange book to have. But, you know, the heart wants what the heart wants. Peter, do you have that book?
I've got the full series of Wanted, so I didn't get the book, although it really annoys me when they do things like that and add an extra issue. It's like when they brought out the Joker Omnibus, the Bronze Age Joker Omnibus. I've got every single issue of that, but they added in an extra unpublished issue of the Joker, and I thought,
Joker number 10.
Come on.
Yeah.
I'm not going to buy an Omnibus just for one issue. No, I might be obsessive, but not that obsessive.
And finally, I'll point out that our good buddy Martin Gray posted a review of the hardcover on his blog, Too Dangerous for a Girl, back when the book came out. And I'll, of course, include a link to that article in the show notes, as Martin wrote a lot more about the contents of that book. All right, back to our comic. So as I mentioned, this came out July of 71. There were some fantastic books published by DC that month. Superman 242, where he fights the Sand Creature. Ghost number 1, which we briefly talked about a few months ago. But the zaniest cover of the month was the Jack Kirby issue of Jimmy Olsen, number 141, that had a picture of Don Rickles on the cover. And I don't know if you remember that comic. That's just crazy.
Oh, yes. I've got all those.
But the coolest book were undoubtedly the 2 DC 100-page Super Spectaculars. Number 4, which spotlighted love stories, and number 5, World Greatest Superheroes, with that awesome Neil Adams cover. They were the 2nd and 3rd ever 100-page DC comics. I do have those, and I'd love to cover those some point on the show. If anybody's interested, just let me know. And then finally, for Marvel, the most significant book this month is probably Amazing Spider-Man number 101. that has the first appearance of Morbius, the living vampire, and of course, Spidey with his extra four arms. So, Peter, how about you? Any favorites from the month?
Well, that Spidey issue actually is something that one of my friends, Craig McIntyre, hi Craig, if you're listening, gave to me when we were both kids.
Oh,
I don't know
nice.
where he'd got it from, but he had that plus a coverless issue of issue 100, a coverless
Nice.
copy of issue 100, which was great. So it had the first two parts of that story, but unfortunately, I didn't really know how it ended for years. So, but it's an absolute classic. Also, that month, got the first issue of Weird War Tales out as well. That hit the stands there, so that's fantastic.
Yeah, were you a War Tales, or do you like the weird part?
I like both, to be honest. I'm not a huge like Sergeant Rock kind of guy,
Right.
but I do like all the mystery stories, and it's
Future
a nice twist.
Commandos.
That sort of stuff is great fun, absolutely fantastic. There's a couple of stories that we've done on Earth 2 on here. You've got the Justice League Justice Society crossover with Solomon Grundy. That's the one where the JLA and the JSA, it's all their actual counterparts that meet up, including the two Robins. So you've got the two Robins, two Atoms, two Hawkmen, two Green Lanterns, etc.
Yeah, I
That was
love
a
that
great
one.
fun one to
That's a
do.
great one. Yeah.
And also Flash issue 209. That's another favorite of mine. That's another one we've done on the podcast. Beyond the Speed of Life, which was great. Yeah, it's an early Kari Bates story. So it's a lot of fun. I absolutely adore Kari Bates on The Flash. It's just some of my favorite comics of all time. It's superb stuff. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff out that month.
All right. Well, thanks as always to our favorite, at least my favorite website, Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Let's get into our comics. Peter, we've got a Murphy Anderson cover here. Would you like to describe what the cover looks like and give us your comments on it?
Absolutely. Now, because it is wanted, it's been actually done up kind of in the style of a wanted poster, almost as if it's been pinned up. You've got some pins in various panels and the shadows coming off the pins dramatically. At the top, DC Special presents Wanted, the World's Most Dangerous Villains. Only 25 cents, approved by the Comics Code Authority. Number 14, October. There we go. There are three big panels on the cover. The top panel, it's Superman, and he is aghast at the Toy Man who has Lois Lane trapped. She is done up as a princess and she's bound on a throne, and there seem to be robot assassins about to attack her. And there's all these sorts of strange strings and threads. The Toy Man's looking gleeful in this. He's incredibly creepy, the Toy Man. Very, very, very creepy.
It's so creepy.
I know. And the caption for that says, Wanted, the Toy Man who put Lois Lane in a Superman-proof death trap. Underneath that, we have Batman, who's also bound. There's a lot of bondage in this, especially considering there's no Wonder Woman in this. It's unusual. Wanted, the Penguin, the bird who blitzed the Batman. Yep, Batman is recoiling because the Penguin is attacking him with a flame coming out the end of his flamethrower umbrella. My goodness. And then, pretty much the reason why I chose this issue is the final panel, and that is Wanted, Captain Cold, who froze the Flash. Heatwave, who fried the Flash? And it is, as you said, the introduction of Heatwave. You have the Flash. He is pained and in agony because on one side of the panel, Captain Cold is blasting him with his cold gun. And on another side, Heatwave, McRory, making his debut, is blasting him with his hot rod. Oh my goodness. Oh, Barry, how are you going to get out of this one?
No, this is great. It's a really fun cover. Murphy Anderson obviously is a master. Everybody looks great on model. When I was a kid, I loved it. And I didn't have this when I was a kid. I've had it for many, many years, but I didn't have it in 1971. But I always thought it was cool, especially like on the Brave and the Bold, they did it a couple times, where Batman would show up and he didn't have the yellow oval. Because then I know, oh, that's the Earth 2 Batman, because that's the way I thought, you know, back then. Now they go back and forth. So I always loved that image of Batman recoiling from the Penguin there because he doesn't have the yellow oval and you know
He
it's
doesn't in
yeah.
that, no.
And so I love that. I love the pins. You mentioned the pin push. They did that on the first one too, and then they carried that theme through. I do think that's kind of a neat theme of how they do the cover. So just looks great all around. Unfortunately, we don't get a table of contents, but I will post the cover and plenty of other pages on our gallery page for DC Special Cast on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. So let's jump into our first story. The story is called The Toy Man's Castle, features, of course, the Earth 2 Superman. It's a 12-pager written by Don Cameron, penciled by Ira Yarbrough, who I was not as familiar with, inked by Stan Kay, and was reprinted from Superman number 47 from 1947, which is awesome. The only other place I found that it was reprinted, other than this comic, was in Superman the Golden Age Omnibus number 6, This story is not yet on. Yeah, unfortunately, it is not yet on DC Universe Infinite. The Golden Age ones stop at number 43. So hopefully they'll get to it not too long. So, Peter, would you like to kick us off?
It starts off with an opening caption, as they often do. With the laughing glee of a child at play in a toy shop, the tricky toy man utilizes a prison workshop to produce amazing gadgets designed to baffle the forces of law and order. And even mighty Superman finds the odds stacked overwhelmingly against him when he takes part in a deadly game to rescue Lois from the threat of the terrible toys, which guard the storybook halls of
the Toy Man's Castle.
And the story goes like this. While in prison, the toy man convinces the warden that he's reformed and to let him create toys that discourage crime. However, his toys are actually robbery plans for his gang. Superman stops the robbery, but figures out his scheme. The warden is about to confine Shot to solitary, but the toy man uses a walking convict doll he has made to blast the wall down and escape. Now at large, the toy man anonymously creates a party machine designed to tell fortunes. His real plan is to steal the signatures of wealthy party guests. Lois attends the party, but sees the toy man when she is leaving. Of course, the toy man then takes her prisoner. Superman catches up with him pretty quickly, and they go to Toyman's secret castle, where he uses Lois as a hostage. She's trapped on a throne with toy knights with swords and axes poised to strike her if any of the strings surrounding her are disturbed. Superman makes his own toy, a jack-in-the-box, which clobbers the Toyman. He then jumps to protect Lois from the knights and captures the Toyman. The end.
So what'd you think of this story? Peter, had you read this story before? I mean, you have read it when you had the book years ago, but had you read it any time
Yes.
in recent past?
I hadn't really read it recently until about half an hour ago. But yes, it is. It's terrific fun. The Toy Man is, as we said, really, really creepy. He's got the strange, long, lank hair. He's got the giant bow tie. He's not quite rotund. He's certainly overweight. And he's got the creepiest looking features. You do not want to meet this guy in a dark alley. It's horrible. And obviously, you know, they did certain things with this character post-crisis,
right,
which made him even more horrible.
Right.
But it's all hinted at here. But I do love the fact that at this stage, we're 10 years into like Superman's career, and he's building up a heck of a rogues gallery, because this isn't the Toy Man's first, second or third appearance. He's been around for quite a bit. There's a similar character called the Prankster, I think he's even more appearances actually by this point. And of course, there's Luther and the Ultra Humanite and other characters. Mixchester Pilk, it's Earth 2, I'm forgetting, not Pitalik.
I can't say it either way,
right.
So.
Very important, the original purple suited is Mixchester Pilk. So yeah, his rogues gallery is really building up. Toy Man is one bizarre factor in it. I do find it really bizarre when prison wardens in these stories say, oh yes, you can go off and have access to tools and equipment and everything. That's great. I see no trouble here. It's like the meme of the dog, cartoon dog with the fire all around him. These prison wardens are totally blinkered, thinking, no. But yeah, this story is delightful and classic Golden Age Lois in Peril, which was fun. But yeah, the artwork's particularly nice as well. I do quite enjoy it. The storytelling's great.
The splash page, I think, is really fascinating. You've got the toy man coming out of the castle on a train with Lois bound on the tracks, Superman flying down, sort of toy guards. This really couldn't be a cover because the Superman figure isn't big enough.
Yeah.
But it is really a fun image. I have a question for you. How does the toy man's game work?
I couldn't figure that out either. I think it's like a series of models where you set up your own robbery or heists. It seems to be sent pretty much just to his gang or a criminal gang that's in cahoots with him. And basically, they see how the crime is going to be foiled, and then they work out from that how to get around that.
Right.
So basically, this game in which the bad guys always lose is basically a way for the bad guys to figure out how they always win.
Right.
But it's not hugely clear in the telling of the story. That's what it is. You have to kind of like read between the lines, I think. But it's still hugely entertaining.
The way that they defeat it is to use an armored cable car that was linked up to their apartment down to the bank.
But like, we've all got one of those kicking about, haven't we? You know,
they're not terribly smart, these guys. Bottom of page 3, we see the guy who's in like a harness drop down through the skylight with a machine gun to rob the jewelry store. And then he goes back up into the cable car, which is looks like an elevator suspended by cable car. Then the idea is they were going to go further down to a bulletproof escape car. But then Superman, of course, shows up to foil the robbery. Wasn't much of a plan.
I mean, they could have done other things, I suppose, but would have had as much style, would have had as much memorability.
I guess not. So Superman goes into their apartment at the top of page 5, and he sees the game set up. And he's like, the game really animates plan for the crimes with one feature to be changed. So Superman figures it out that the game is not legit, and he calls the warden. Meanwhile, the toy man, as you say, has been in the shop building another toy, which is a walking convict doll.
Yeah, because, of course, lots of convicts love playing with dolls. They're renowned for that. It's bizarre. But it's not only that. It's an exploding walking convict doll. How did he get access to explosives in this workshop? I think the warden should be checking his inventory more thoroughly.
What is a very interesting touch. The warden is a gardener. Just out of the blue, the warden's out by the fence. He's got his sleeves rolled up. He's got like gardening outfit. He's like a real gardener. I'm like, what a weird personality trait to give the warden, who's got a very minor role in the story. I thought that was a very interesting touch. And of course, the doll explodes the wall, knocks everybody out. Off the toy man goes. So a couple days later, the toy man has designed this Swami electronic fortune-telling machine. You want to explain how that worked?
The idea of that, I believe, is that the guests sign their name and up comes their fortune from the Swami. It's like the old, what is it, Zoltar? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, I think Zoltar, yeah.
It's a bit like that. That's kind of like the look they've given this particular toy, as it were. And there's a screen in front of him. And basically, the toy man is using this to capture signatures of these guests so that he can forge them and transfer money through bank checks. Remember bank checks? Remember that was a thing?
Actually, if you think about it, for 1947, that's not a bad plan, right?
Definitely.
Right? Uh-huh. I mean, if you had a check and you could forge the signature, and that's not a bad plan. I don't know how long it would last till people figured it out. Although his disguise leaves something to be. He looks just like the toy man in his crazy coat with a giant bow tie, but he wore sunglasses. Mm-hmm. So that disguised him, I guess.
Well, it works for Clark Kent to a certain extent. So,
I guess. Lois is all dolled up. She's at the party. But then after the party, the toy man's there and he runs into Lois and throws a pillowcase over her head to drag her away. Poor Lois.
I know. But fortunately, Superman's on hand and manages to track down the toy man. I do like the fact that when Toy Man's captured by Superman, pretty much straight away, Toy Man says, "Before we go to the police, Superman, can't we visit my secret castle?" If I was Superman, I would say no. But this is before he knows that Lois is captured. But Superman agrees to go to Toy Man's secret castle. It's like, actually, no, Toy Man, I'm fine. Thanks.
There couldn't be a trap there or anything, right?
But no, Superman's quite happy to fly him to this castle. When did this pop up? Did he make this after he escaped prison? Was this something that he'd had made before? Because it's incredible. I'd like to move in.
Yeah.
Because it's a huge castle, but it's got like a giant model railway going all the way around it, which he likes to drive, saying toot toot, as you do.
Like Walt Disney.
Very Walt Disney, yes. Big gothic doors, knights in armor on horseback. There's a throne room. It's very grand. A medieval Willy Wonka. Perhaps.
Was a castle part of the Toy Man's shtick? Not a Toy Man expert.
Not that I can recall, no. You think if the castle had been, Superman would have said, Toy Man has escaped. I will go and check his secret castle.
That's true.
But he didn't. It's bizarre.
So then we get another fun scene. You got Lois and you've got all these sort of automatons, I guess is the word you would use, that are like puppets. And there's strings attached everywhere. There's big ones. And there's also, you have to look really closely, but there are little ones. If you look at the middle of page 10, they're little, I think they're little little toys with guns or something. All these different
McFarlane figures. That's what they are.
All these different McFarlane figures are poised to strike Lois if she moves or Superman approaches her. So Superman says, "Can I use your workshop, Toyman?"
The leaps in logic of this are hysterical. It's great.
Bottom of page 10, he says, "Before I go, may I give her a present to help her pass the time?"
You can't beat Golden Age comics, and you can't beat Superman doing this sort of thing. It's just so much fun. It's ridiculous. And off he goes into his workshop and starts tinkering away, as you do.
And the surprise is he counts on, this is part of smart of Superman, he counts on Toy Man wanting to inspect the package before he gives it to Lois. And Toy Man opens up the package, and inside is a little tiny Superman Jack in the Box that clobbers the Toy Man coming out of the box. I love that. That's my favorite panel of the story, is where the little Superman clobbers the Toy Man. I like that little touch. Totally unnecessary. Superman could have done the same thing that he did next, which is go and cover up Lois while all these weapons strike her.
Exactly. He just needed the distraction first. That's all. It's a McFarlane Superman with a spring. That's all it is. That's all he did. Coil up a spring and put a McFarlane figure of himself on it. I don't know. He probably gets a cut of the money for that as well. All the automatons try and attack Lois, but Superman's there protecting her. Also, if you look above Lois, as well as all these automatons with all their weapons attacking, there's like a weighted, kind of spiky
Oh, I didn't
bit thing
notice
about.
that before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About to descend on her. So Superman's there protecting her from all this. And then he rushes back out to grab the Toy Man's detonator before, well, detonator that he has to self-destruct the castle. So Superman swipes that away before Toy Man can have the final victory. Boo.
It seems that the warden finally gets it, because now he says, "Oh, no more toy making for you. Good idea, Mr. Warden."
Put him to work in the garden instead. Great fun, ridiculous fun, well worth reprinting. Well done, DC, for choosing this one.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a kid, like you said, if you're a kid in the 70s, there's no way you would have ever had a chance to read the stories. These
No.
books filled a real void and gave access to some of these titles.
And I think roughly around about this time, they reintroduced Toyman into the Superman continuity. I can't remember if that happened before or after this issue, but the Earth One Toyman made his debut around about here. That was the early 70s as well, I believe.
That would make sense why they would have chosen the story then. So that's a good point. All right, final thoughts on this story before we move on?
Oh, just ridiculous fun.
Yeah.
I think you'll probably see that for all three of these stories.
Oh, yeah.
Ridiculous fun.
Well, the second one's a Silver Age classic, as we've mentioned before, the first appearance of Heatwave, but also stars the Captain Cold and features, of course, the Flash, Barry Allen of Earth One. It's entitled The Heat Is On for Captain Cold, a 15-pager written by John Broom, penciled by Carmine Infantino, and inked by Joe Giella, and reprinted from The Flash number 140. Now, this one is widely available. You can read it on DC Universe Infinite. Just search for Flash number 140. It was in the Showcase Presents Flash Volume 2 trade paperback, Flash Archives Volume 5, a trade paperback called Flash versus the Rogues from 2010, and the Flash Silver Age Omnibus Volume 2 from 2017. This one's a lot more available, so feel free to read along. So I'll start this one off in the Earth 2 style. Two arch villains battling away in a stupendous crime rivalry. The city in danger of destruction, and only the Flash standing between it and terrible menace. And if that weren't enough, there's also mystery, intrigue, and glamour in this exciting story, which we call The
It
Heat Is
is
On,
on for
Captain
Captain
Cold.
Cold.
Iris West, who's looking gorgeous in her evening dress and updo, is not happy with her fiance Barry Allen. She's upset at Barry for staring at a different gorgeous girl on TV named the Dream Girl. No, not that one. Barry quickly explains that he was just doing research. Good one, Barry. He tells Iris that the Flash was asked by Henry Willens, an attorney, to search for a missing girl that was lost in an accident many years before. Her father has died recently, and his dying wish was to locate the girl. A diamond-shaped birthmark on the back of her neck is the only clue that Flash has to her identity. So Barry was just checking out every young woman's neck to see if he could find the girl. But there is a time limit. The Flash has only 24 hours to locate the young woman, or she will miss out on her $2 million inheritance. Worse yet, Central City would miss out on a $10 million contribution to aid the poor. If she is not found by this deadline, all the money would go to, quote, a couple of ne'er-do-well relatives unworthy of the inheritance. Oh my goodness. While searching for her, the Flash learns that Captain Cold has broken out of jail. He quickly catches up to Snart, but is prevented from making the capture due to the interference of a new villain, Heatwave. Heatwave teams up temporarily with Cold, but later the two have a dispute over the affections of who else but Dream Girl. The two crooks compete in a crime spree to win her heart, as you do. But they pause their rivalry again when the Flash shows up. They shoot the Flash from either side so that he is freezing and roasting at the same time, of course, recreating our cover scene. But of course, the Flash overcomes both opponents by using the old arm rotating trick to create a vacuum between the villains so they smash into each other in a head-on collision. Learning of the crook's passion for Dream Girl gives Flash an idea. He meets Dream Girl, who, since she's the only other woman in the story, turns out to be the missing girl. Flash takes her to Mr. Willens to receive her inheritance, and Central City gets its money too. The end. Peter, what'd you think of this story?
Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I'm a huge Barry Flash fan. He's my favorite character. Okay. I'll be honest. It's as I said earlier on, I love Kari Bates' Flash, the Flash that really got me into comics. Kari Bates does a lot of stuff with the Rogues, making them weird, but it's John Broome that really started off making the Rogues, giving them all these weird personality traits, like, for example, Captain Cold as a ladies' man.
I know.
Self-titled ladies' man. It's hilarious. He falls in love with someone every single appearance.
And he thinks that by doing the crimes, he's impressing them.
I know. It's great. It's superb. So yeah, this has got John Broome all over it. Also, the opening splash page has got another one of my favorite things, and that is, in the background, the Carmine Infantino cityscape. All the action's in the foreground, and then you've got in the very, very distant background all these giant skyscrapers, but they're all tiny because they're all in the background. Don't focus on that. I love a Carmine cityscape. It's so good.
Central City was always like this city, and then there's nothing around it. I always love that.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. And again, John Broome coming up with such a wacky, weird plot. Let's start off at the beginning. It kicks off with Barry and Iris coming home after they've been out, and they both look incredible. Barry's in his tux.
No, Iris looks gorgeous.
She's got the long gloves on up to almost her shoulder.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of soiree have they been at? I mean, I want to know what that was. That was great. Is it some sort of awards ceremony? Was the Flash getting yet another Man of the Year award? Because they seem to get them all the time in the Silver Age.
And they make it a point, John Broome, to say that it's a coffee cap, not a nightcap.
Yes, a coffee cap. We know what that means. I like the asterisk, that caption saying, yes, this is before Barry and Iris married.
I had that note too. I love that too.
So great, a lovely wee addition there. Yeah, Barry, it does look like a guy who's desperately trying to come up with a, yes, I was staying in that girl, Iris, because it's to do with an inheritance. It's, it's very, have you ever watched Blackadder?
No, I haven't watched that. I've heard of
no?
it.
No, okay. There's an episode of Blackadder where he's having a party and someone bursts in and he says, great booze up, Edmund. He's got some, I think it's his auntie, I think, or someone like that, who's a complete abstinent and it's like totally frowns and everything. And she says, what does this mean? Great booze up. You see him thinking, Brown Atkinson thinking, and he says, can you explain this? I can. my friend is a missionary. One of the tribe he was looking after had fallen under some sort of sleeping sickness, but apparently it's cured because great booze up. So it does did remind me of that instantly. It's just like someone desperately coming up for an explanation, but it's true.
I don't blame her. You look at Iris, who's looking pretty hot, and he's like looking at this other girl. It's like, I don't know what's wrong with you, Barry. No, that was a great scene.
Yeah, that shipwreck though in the flashback, I want to know what the story is there, because it's literally like one ship going right into the middle of another ship, like forming a T-shape. What kind of maritime disaster is this? My goodness, what caused that?
Well, I love this aspect of the time of a DC Heroes where this random lawyer trying to locate this girl decides to call the Flash and ask for help. And the Flash does. You never see that kind of story nowadays. I just think that's so charming, right? It's just like, you know, we can't have these ne'er-do-wells get the money.
What kind of will is that? It's like, if you find my daughter within a year, then she can have 2 million and 8 can go to charity. But if you don't find her, then all of it goes to these horrible distant relatives. You could have just given it all to charity. No. You have to find my daughter. Okay.
Why wait until you're dead to find the daughter? Why not put some of that money towards finding the daughter ahead of time? I don't understand.
Exactly. He could have hired the Flash. Yeah. There was that time, actually that was after this. There was the time, the story that had Moppy in it, the real origin of the Flash.
Yeah.
Where the Flash had to basically become a Flash for hire to earn money so that he could get the chemicals to recreate the experiment that gave him his powers. This is in continuity, folks. If it had been at that time, then this could have been one of the odd jobs that he did. He could have done this. Right. But there you go. But yeah, put an advert in the paper, whatever.
Yeah, this page is not one I'll put in the gallery, page three, because there is so much exposition on this page. It is literally half the page is full of words. It's unbelievable.
Clermontian in its explanation.
Yeah. So Barry finishes his story to Iris and says, well, that's what I was doing, Iris. Naturally, since I was talking to Flash, I've been peeking at the backs of all the girls I see. Well, she says, that's as an original excuse I've ever heard.
And then, of course, there's a news flash. Captain Cold has escaped from prison because they built a cold gun out of some spare freezer parts in the prison workshop.
Sorry, once again.
What is happening? There is a theme here. I think someone should properly review the status of these prison wardens in the DC universe, because they're all incompetent. They give us great stories, but they're all incompetent. So
then we get the part you're talking about. We shift to Captain Cold, who's got some sort of cave hideout, and he's got this giant poster of the Dream Girl, which I think is just classic.
That's brilliant. It's just headed Dream Girl as well. I wonder if that's actual merch from their show, because she's not given an actual name. And this show just seems to be her saying goodnight to people, because her dialogue's, this is your TV Dream Girl here to say goodnight to you and you and to wish you pleasant dreams. That's all that we get of this show. We have no idea what else this show's all about. So as far as I'm concerned, it's a show where she turns up just to say goodnight and all the guys go, ah, I'm going to have pleasant dreams, Dream Girl. Thank you. So I think this might be merch from the show. Who knows?
Yeah,
who
maybe. Knows? So then a lot more exposition about why he likes Dream Girl and he wants to do a super crime. He goes to a bank where they're transferring money or something. And I did not know his cold gun could do this. So as a Flash expert, have you seen the cold gun do this? He freezes a cloud to cause lightning, but it's an icy lightning that freezes the guards. Why not just freeze the guards with the whole gun? Like, that seemed like a lot of trouble to go to. Is that something Captain Cold regularly does? Because I don't recall that.
He does some weird things from time to time. Right at the start, when he first came on the scene, he used to use his cold gun to create mirages all the time.
Oh, yeah, that I remember.
Usually of giant insects for some reason. But yeah, that was the thing. This is something I've not seen before or since. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But
as I said,
I'm a huge Flash fan, and I've got a full run from 107 up to the end, up to 350. I'm missing 105 and 106. They're just out of my price range. And I've got them in reprint several times over, so I'm fine. but I don't recall this at all. But yeah, it's fun. I mean, why not? Challenge yourself. If you're a genius rogue and you're doing such low-rent things as bank heists, then make it fun for yourself.
After the interstitial, we get a couple ads. We'll come back and talk about the ads in a minute. We get the Flash, who's about to capture Captain Cold. But this is where we see Heatwave show up. The first appearance of his heat gun, middle of page 9, it looks like a lighter.
Yeah, a Zippo.
It's supposed to look like a gun, but it's really a cigarette lighter. And that's what it looks like. He snaps it with his thumb and a little tiny flame comes out, but somehow that flame stops the Flash.
No, I always loved Heatwave's hot rod. It does look ridiculous. And yeah, it's like the handle of it, the hilt of it. Basically like a Zippo with like an extended gun barrel. It's ridiculous. And also I've always loved his giant holster that he has across his chest as well.
And
his asbestos suits. It's a basic but practical costume. Yeah.
Here, a question for you. It feels to me, reading this story cold, no pun intended.
No pun intended.
It feels like Heatwave was supposed to be more of a one-off. It's just a foil for Captain Cold, right? They said, we've got Captain Cold, who's been our recurring villain. You know, it's great for the Flash because you can make him slip and you can see why he'd be a foe for the Flash. Okay, great. Oh, let's create a hot guy instead as a foil for him. Yeah. But of course, Heatwave returns and becomes a regular rogue. They're like, now, did you get that feeling just by reading this story that Heatwave was sort of a one-off throwaway type character?
No, I think, you know, he does fall into more of the rogue category because of the type of gimmick that he has. There's some other characters that definitely feel like one-offs in these stories, but especially the ones that John Broome writes as opposed to the ones Gardner Fox writes at this time. Gardner Foxes tend to be more disposable. I think when John Broome room rights, like a character like this, I think he gets a wee niggle in his head thinking, I could do something with that. I could do something with that. It's an easy guess. It's like, let's do an opposite.
Right.
But then once you have that character, it's like, well, I could do something with that character. So yeah. And obviously when the Rogues Gallery actually builds up and once they start actually meeting up, then that adds a whole other dimension to it.
Right. Then they start getting personalities and stuff. Like, all we know about Captain Cold is that he likes the ladies, right? We do know that.
He likes the ladies.
And so does Heatwave. Heatwave, of course, is also in love with Green Girl. So that's not a unique characteristic for Heatwave yet.
It looks like all of Central City is pretty much in love with Dream Girl. So, you know, they're not alone. if you can do merch for giant posters for her, then surely, you know, that's a thing. So there we go.
They knock the Flash out and they go back and they decide, hey, we'll team up. Let's go back to my headquarters, the cave. And they're sitting in the cave with a little candle. They don't have much tech in the cave. There's a candle and they're talking. And Heatwave's like, oh, wait. You've got this giant picture of Dream Girl here, Captain Cold. And Captain Cold says, yes, I'm in love with her. I'm going to create the greatest crime so that she loves me. And he's like, wait, so am I. And so they have their first fight where they each shoot their guns at each other and they cancel each other out. So Heatwave stalks out.
No, it's wonderful. I've always wondered how many of these secret cave hideaways there are for the Rogues scattered around the outskirts of Central City, because they've all got one.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Basically, anytime one of these guys is on the loose, Flash would just basically run round the outskirts of Central City, having a wee look in the caves, doing some super speed spelunking and seeing what he can see.
Yeah, it's like the abandoned card factories in Gotham City, right?
Yeah, and and carnivals and all sorts. Or the warehouse district in a Spider-Man comic.
Right, exactly. So then I thought it was an interesting choice off panel. In between panels 2 and 3 of page 11 is a time where they're each trying to pull off more and more spectacular heists to impress Dream Girl. And the Flash is saying, oh, I've got to stop these guys. There's some sort of crime contest going on. I've got to figure it out. So I thought that was an interesting choice. We don't get to see them. Right? No. We had all this exposition previously, but we don't get to see them. You could see like a modern thing where you'd have top and bottom or left and right of a page where they'd each be
a nice
pulling
montage
off
scene.
A little montage. Yeah, yeah, where they'd be pulling off these things. But we don't get it. All we get is some Carmine speed lines of Flash running around.
And a voice in the radio.
Another bank assaulted. And they're fighting each other. Pop at page 12. You want to talk about that scene?
Again, kicks off with Flash running into another Carmine cityscape. He seems to be very far away from the city, but the area's all slabs, lovely. Very nice decorative slabs. But there's a huge blast of energy from behind the skyscrapers. But of course, Flash is here in an instant and he sees Heatwave and Captain Cold facing off, trying to blast at each other with their various weapons. And there's a bit of banter there between the two rogues when they spot the Flash. And they think, hang on, let's just team up and get this guy first, then we'll sort out our differences.
Their first smart move.
That's it.
And then bottom of 12, we get the recreation of the cover scene where they are each firing and the Flash is, you know, burning on one side and freezing on the other side, which is fantastic. Now I have another question for you again, being the Flash expert. I don't think it's the very first time. Flash has been around for a while now. Talk to me your feelings about how the Flash has control of every molecule in his body.
I love it. See, that's something that's kind of been lost in modern storytelling, is that modern Flash stories is all about speed and speed and speed and speed.
Speed force and right.
Yeah, that's it. Back in the Silver and Bronze Age, it was more about working through the problem. And because he could control his molecular vibratory rate, as it were, he could do things like vibrate through materials, could vibrate into other universes, as we discovered. I think it's actually a more powerful ability than a super speed in some ways, because it's like he can feel every single molecule in his body and control it to a certain extent, not in a shape-shifting kind of way, but just in a ability to channel it and move them and vibrate them at different rates and things. So he's got a different kind of sense in relation to that. Yeah. And that's something that's completely missing from the modern comics with, as you said, the Speed Force. And it's more of a Julie Schwartz science explanation, which I love. Yeah,
it's comic book science, right?
Exactly. I mean, you've got the editor's note here that says, along with his super speed, the Flash has absolute control over all the atoms and molecules of his body, which is great. I mean, going back to what we're saying about early comics, one of the first comics that I got as well was one where the Flash was up against Dr. Alchemy, and Dr. Alchemy uses the Philosopher's Stone to basically transform him into a cloud, and the Flash uses his molecular control to bang his molecules together and literally start raining and reforming his body. And this just blew my mind as a youngster. It was just, oh, is there any wonder this guy turned out to be my favorite character when he could do that sort of stuff? Wonderful. And think outside the box that way. It's just, oh yeah, that's fine. I'm just, I'm coming apart. Oh no, I know. Bang, 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 bang. And down comes the rain. Yeah, so I love that.
Yeah, I love it too. I think it's really interesting because if you think about real life science, speed and heat mm-hmm. and cold are all related, mm-hmm. right? The hot yeah. is when mm-hmm. things move faster and cold is when things move slower. And so the linkage of all these things actually makes mm-hmm. logical sense. I do think the ability to learn something, even though this is fantastical and the things yeah, that Barry yeah. does is fantastical, sort of understanding mm-hmm. those types of connections, I think really helped me out as a kid understand other more practical scientific things. I don't know. I think it was great.
Absolutely.
You know, all the flash facts that were in there and mm-hmm. things like that are just fantastic, I think, for the kids back in the day. So
yeah, we knew what molecules were before, you know, anyone else did. That was right. it, just by reading yeah. Flash comics.
Just by reading the Flash. That's absolutely
we
absolutely
could understand
right.
it. It's great.
So the Flash reforms himself and then he kind of disposes of the two villains pretty easily.
Yeah, all the dangers out the way. They're both standing there. He's defeated them and basically just... Another thing I love about the Flash is he's kind of like playful with the rogues yeah. sometimes. He's just like, I mean, here he causes a super speed vacuum in between Captain Cold and Heatwave that basically draws them together so they knock each other out with a big clunk, which is hilarious. He could have just like grabbed both of them and ran them to prison, but no, he's having a bit of fun with it. You know, it's great. These guys have literally just tried to freeze and burn me. So no, you're not getting away with that. Bang, there you go. And then he drops them off in jail after he's clunked their heads together.
So Flash as... figured out, and we get the conclusion where he goes to Dream Girl, and it turns out that she had the birthmark removed when she became a model so she could wear an updo. Mm-hmm. And we get the happy ending. I tell you, Carmen Infantino was able to draw some very lovely ladies.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm.
I really did not care for his artwork at the end of the Flash's run right before Crisis. I was much more of an Irv Novik fan. That's when I first started reading The Flash, was Irv Novik, of course.
Me too.
And then when Carmine Infantino came back, I really did not have the appreciation yeah. for it. But when I've gone back sure. and read, like I have all the Flash archives, mm-hmm. I've read all these stories, and some of his artwork is really fantastic and mm-hmm, mm-hmm. ingenious.
Yeah.
Cityscapes notwithstanding.
It's looser, later style I call Chunky Infantino, because everyone likes a bit yeah. bulkier than that. Yeah. But basically he was... doing things so quickly there, it was yeah. second nature to him then.
I think he was also resentful. He had to earn a living, and I think mm-hmm. you know, he had gone to Marvel yeah. and did Spider-Woman, and I didn't mm-hmm. know this, but I read an article, I think in back issue or one of the American History of Comics mm-hmm. books from Tomorrow's. Basically, when he came back to DC, he never once mm-hmm. went into the office. He refused yeah. to go into mm-hmm. the DC offices. There were people there, whether it was Jeanette Kahn or Paul Levitz or whoever had replaced him. I assume it was Jeanette. Yeah. He mm-hmm. wanted nothing to do with them. And so, but he would work on The Flash and he came back to it. But my headcanon, right, is that his mm-hmm. heart wasn't in mm-hmm. it as much.
I can definitely see that. Yeah. Although I must admit, the final panel of this story, there's a lovely full moon looming in the background. So take a drink.
Take a drink, your Earth 2 podcast friends. Very good. Yes, we get Barry and Iris off on another adventure. Barry's got a nice car, a convertible.
Oh, yeah, huh? He's got a phone in it at one stage as well. He actually has a car phone at one stage.
Awesome story. Final thoughts?
Just wonderful. And the fact that there's a character in it called Dream Girl was part of the reason I chose this issue, yeah. because that's one of the things we do in the Earth 2 podcast, is we have fun with what we call legacy, which is basically reuse of character names. Yeah. And obviously, in the 30th century or 31st, depending on which version of the Legion you're looking at, there is, of course, a member of the Legion of Superheroes called Dream Girl.
1963, I don't think Dream Girl was invented yet, right? She
exactly. So this is a precursor. So yes.
So this would fall under your remit.
It certainly would. I might do a Legion special at some point and mention this story awesome. And refer people to this episode.
Real quick, I'd like to talk about a couple of ads and features in the book, since we have both mm-hmm. physical copies. So at the bottom of page 8 of the Flash story, we get a tremendous ad for a Make It a Giant DC Summer. And it's a Lois Lane giant, 35 cents. And it says it's for the summer, so it's not Valentine's Day, but it's hearts all over. And every one of her is kissing Superman. That's a fantastic cover.
Yeah, it's mostly, I think it's all reprint, I think. One of the stories in that we did on the Earth 2 podcast as well, The Girl Who Mourned Superman. You tune into that episode to find out why we covered that one. But yes, so that was good. Yes, I love Lois and Jimmy's stories. They're just ridiculous.
You know, I'm much more of a Lois fan. I had at one point a near complete run. I've since sold them,
Wow.
but of Lois Lane, I got a bunch of them all from one vendor at a real good price once. And then I didn't have a totally complete run, but I had 90% of them. And I went and did a read through of them all like a couple of years ago before I sold them. And there's some wacky stuff in there, let me tell
Oh,
you.
it's great. It's great. I mean, they just embrace the Silver Age silliness, and it's just so ridiculous. Lois and Lana are both trying to trick each other as well. It's just, I will make Superman marry me. And that sort of thing. It's so bizarre and so ridiculous and so enjoyable. Just don't take it seriously, and it's great fun.
At the center spread of the book, we have a Columbia House. Now, did they have anything like Columbia House in the UK?
Not to my knowledge, there probably was, but not at this period, to my knowledge, because most, I'll be honest, most of the stuff I was reading was US comics. There's nothing like this printed in any of the UK comics that I was
I see.
reading.
Well, I did have Columbia House probably when I was in high school for a couple of years, where I got my first car, which was sort of a hand-me-down from my grandfather. I took out the AM radio that was in it and replaced it with an AM/FM 8-track tape thing. I actually did that
What?
myself, crawled under the dashboard and replaced it. I was much handier, let alone smaller back in those days. But I had a Columbia House with 8-track tapes that I got. Had it probably for 1 or 2
Excellent.
years. But I love how you could take your pick, you 8-tracks or cassettes or LP records, or you could also go get reel-to-reel tapes. I'm like,
Amazing.
wow.
Amazing. I think 8 tracks is archaic technology, but reel to reel is fantastic. I think my uncle might still have a reel to reel machine somewhere.
Wow, that's really neat.
In about 1992, I worked in a bank and they had an old 8-track system to play music, and it was awful. It was really bad. I remember that Run DMC Aerosmith Walk This Way was one of the tracks on it for some reason. That must have been like the last 8-track ever produced, happened to have that on it. Bizarre. But yeah, 8 tracks. I thought it was just a thing that happened in the States. I don't think we had it over here at all until I saw it in the bank that day. My goodness.
So I have to tell you, I didn't have it in the notes here, Peter, but I realized as I was rereading the story last night, after page 13, there's an SSP car ad. So these are plastic vehicles that you put a pull strip in, you pull the strip out real fast, it goes vroom, and then
Oh,
the
yeah.
cars will run off. I believe I had this top one, the Black Widow. I believe I had that
Wow.
when I was a kid. So this was 1971, so I would have been six in 1971.
Okay.
I remember had a couple of these, and there was another line or a group of them later that were intended to smash into things, and they're like doors and trunk lids and stuff would fly off. The Demolition Derby type. Well, Demolition
Wow,
Derby was real
okay.
big in the mid-70s in the US. I remember I had a couple of these toys. See if anybody else in the listening crowd ever had these SSP toys. I don't know. Did you have anything like this?
We had matchbox cars, but they don't remember having anything really that you pull until the Evel Knievel sets came out and you'd wind that up and he would go off. But I'm not saying they didn't exist, I just don't remember them. These, I think I remember seeing an old TV advert.
Oh, really? That's
Not
cool.
a UK advert, but one from the US. Because this is very familiar, but it's nothing that we had here. But I do remember when you talked about the Demolition Derby thing, I thought, you know, that's, I'm sure I've seen an old US advert on YouTube or somewhere.
But yeah, last night I looked at that Black Widow. I'm like, wait a minute, I think I had that.
It's almost like a one-wheel Batmobile, you know. It's
It's cool,
very
isn't it?
sleek with the Black Widow hourglass on it. So yeah, very nice.
And then the last thing I'll mention, we don't talk a lot about it, but there's a letter from Carmine Infantino, the editorial director, apologizing for the price increase. I assume this would have been when they went from 12 to 15 cents.
Yeah, looks like it.
He says, we'd like to thank you for buying this DC comic, even though it costs you more than usual. We're going to tell it like it is. And if you must know, the cost of producing old comics has continued to increase, blah, blah, blah. I've said this on other episodes. I just find it fascinating that the comics companies, Marvel did it too, that they would have to really explain to their customers why they have to increase prices. I just think that's really so quaint.
I mean, they were 12 cents for such a long, long time, but they did shrink in size over that period. The page count got less and less over that period, but the price point stayed the same. So I can understand. Yeah, I mean, these days, remember DC? Oh gosh, it's over a decade now. They made a big deal about drawing the line at $2.99, and then that lasted about 6 months, I think. But yes, they didn't do any sort of editorial letter like that in the comics to explain it.
Well, and even both DC and Marvel did the still only 25 cents or still only 35 cents when the other company had raised it. They took that advantage for the last couple of months that they could hold out, still, hey, we're still cheaper. And then, oh, they're the
That's it.
same now again. That kind of thing you mentioned about being engrossed in the hobby. I love reading the stories, fascinated by the business of comics, both current and aftermarket. I like buying and selling. I just like everything about it. And that kind of stuff is really fascinating to me, is those types of business
Me
practices.
too. Me too.
All right. I think we're ready to move on to our third and final story. It features Batman and Robin of Earth 2 versus the Penguin. And it's called The Bird Sayings Crimes, 12 pages, written by Bill Wulfalk, penciled by Lou Schwartz, and inked by Stan Kay again. And this one's reprinted from World's Finest Comics number 55 from 1952. The only place I could find it reprinted was in Batman: The Golden Age Omnibus Volume 8. So I'll try to put as many pages as I can in the gallery. Take it away, Peter.
Again, kicks off with a caption. The wise old saying tells us to learn from the birds. That zealous but zany devotee of bird law, the penguin, learned too well and used his knowledge to hatch the cleverest crimes of his career. But when he let those caped minions of the law, Batman and Robin, in on his plans before he carried them out, expecting to trap them, he was forced to sing a different tune. For the most amazing and ingenious penguin tale of all time, read
The
The
Bird
Bird Sayings
Sayings Crimes.
Crimes. So, this tale begins in the aviary. That's the headquarters of the bulbous but brilliant bird of prey, the penguin. Ozzy is ranting because he's received letters from his criminal brethren saying that he's washed up. Worse yet, they are using bird saying puns to make fun of him. Penguin decides to double down in bird sayings to plan his crimes and even send Batman clues ahead of time. Hang on, is that not what the Riddler does? He sends a fantastic handwritten note with drawings to police headquarters for Batman and Robin to figure out. They figure out that a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, meant Penguin was hiding in the hand of the Statue of Liberty, which apparently is in Gotham Harbor on Earth 2, while a trained homing pigeon steals gems from a ship passing below. The dynamic duo foils his plans and recovers the jewels, but the penguin gets away. Similar escapades ensue two more times with the sayings, birds of a feather flock together, and the early bird gets the worm, but Batman and Robin cannot apprehend the penguin. As they follow the penguin's trail, Batman and Robin are puzzling over the last clue. A drawing of Batman and Robin standing on the scale reading £14, entitled My Greatest Triumph. They hear Q, Q, Q coming from a nearby house, and Batman suddenly understands the clue and realizes they are in deadly danger. That is the call of the stone bird. Of course, one stone is £14 in the UK, obviously, and Batman and Robin are the two birds that the penguin intends to kill. They've walked right into his trap. The penguin binds the dynamic duo inside the house and tells them that at dawn, the stone bird they heard will fly out of the house to get breakfast, triggering an electric eye, setting off an explosion that will decimate the house, and Batman and Robin killing two birds with one stone. But of course, Penguin forgot to relieve them of their utility belts, silly Billy. Knowing that the bird would not leave the nest if her egg was hatching, Batman and Robin use paint to disguise a marble to look like the egg of a stone bird and toss it up into the nest. The bird stays put, giving them time to work their way out of the ropes and capture the penguin. The end.
I tell you, these Batman Golden Age stories are complex.
They're wonderful. I don't know about you, but this screamed Adam West at me so much. So much. It's wonderful. It is joyous in the reading of it. I mean, this is from 1952 originally, or 1951, actually. It's incredible because it really does sound like Adam West, Burt Ward, and Burgess Meredith saying all these lines. The plot feels as if it could literally be cut and paste into a script from the Batman TV series. I think you're a fan of the Adam West Batman.
Sure. Well, you know what's interesting is I love the story that, what's his name? Dozier picked up a bunch of Batman comics and read them. You can imagine this being one of them that he probably was too late, you know, because he would have read ones from the 60s. But yeah, I agree with you. This definitely could be, especially the scene at the beginning where he's ranting in his aviary about getting all these notes from these other crooks, like making fun of him on his birthday.
It's wonderful. It's,
Like,
I mean,
wow.
they're all sending telegrams and notes and messages. It's just ridiculous. Just taking the mickey out of them. You don't need to. It's just, oh, it's joyous, absolutely joyous. And again, great character work. Batman probably is the best rogues gallery out of everyone, let's be honest. And Penguin is the number two, really, pretty much
Yeah.
up until like the Bronze Age after the Joker, but he's fallen away a bit since. But I'm just looking at the panels of him just now and just picturing Burgess Meredith.
Yeah, ranting and
And it's
raving,
just,
yeah.
it's wonderful. It's
Yeah.
just great.
I love the opening scene, but I am fascinated. Okay, look at the top of page three, and we see this card that the Penguin has drawn and sent to police headquarters. Commissioner Gordon gives it to Batman. I just think this is fantastic. It's like a child would have drawn this. Why don't you describe?
It starts off as a handwritten note saying, "Dear Batman and Robin, pictured below are the complete plans for my next crimes. Try and stop me," signed the Penguin. And they're actually numbered as well. Number one, you've got a hand holding a bird that says the 3rd of the month on it. Number two, you have some birds flying as the ducks. They look a bit like ducks to me. And it says the 5th of the month beside it. Number three, you have a rising sun with a picture of a bird pulling a worm out of the ground. It says the 7th of the month. And then number four, you have Batman and Robin standing on a big weighing scale that says 14 pounds. And the caption beside that says, "My greatest triumph." Get it? My goodness.
I don't know. I just think that's fabulous. They realize that the way the hand is drawn has lines across it that look like the welding lines of the hand of the Statue of Liberty is where the bird is sitting. And then they go to the Statue of Liberty, which, like I said, is apparently in Gotham Harbor, which I think
In
is
Gotham,
fantastic.
yes. Unless they've got their own Statue of Liberty, perhaps there's two. Maybe the citizens of Gotham thought, "Do you know what? We quite like that Statue of Liberty. Let's just make our own, shall we?"
Okay, maybe they did. Fair enough. A lot of the Batman tales from this time, right? They'd have a setup, they'd have a couple of interactions where Batman and Robin can't quite catch the crook. And then, of course, at the end, they do. So we get this first scene. They're in the Batcave trying to decipher all these clues, which I just think is funny. They're looking at it with magnifying glass. Robin's got the encyclopedia out. They're just trying to figure out what this means. And I just love that.
Again, I can't read this without thinking of Adam West and Burt Ward. The dialogue just screams their voices at me. It's basic detection that they're doing, you know, but
Yeah, but it is
all the
detecting.
knowledge. It's detecting, yeah. All the knowledge of like diving into the books to discover what could this mean? What could this mean? Back in the good old days with that lamp. Is that a lamp they have hanging in the background?
I think it's some sort of lamp that's shining over Robin's book or something, and then there Batman's looking in a microscope and he's got a beaker behind him, like doing all kinds of scientific stuff. It doesn't mean anything.
Science,
To
great stuff.
the next page, they do go to the Statue of Liberty, they foil the penguin. And the penguin gets away. Explain this one to me. He gets away. They get the jewels back, so he doesn't get away with the jewels, but he falls into the water and he swims away under the water using the shaft of his umbrella as a breathing tube. And I'm like, didn't Batman and Robin see the top of the umbrella?
He's fully submerged, so I'm guessing he must have some sort of oxygen cylinder hidden within the actual
Oh.
parasol part of the umbrella because he is fully underwater. It's not sticking out.
Oh. I thought the parasol part was above the water. So you're saying he's fully submerged and it's some. Oh, okay. All right, I'll buy that.
From the colouring, it looks like he's fully submerged. Otherwise, Batman and Robin would say, "Look, there he is." Fairly easy to spot.
And then the next two pages is the strangest one. Birds of a feather flock together, which is the hardest one to interpret from the picture. It's a bunch of descendants of Ezekiel Bird, BYRD, some a Revolutionary War hero who get together in a cave, another cave, and give out a prize to one of their number. I'm like, that's got to be something based on something. It's just too bizarre.
Yeah, is this the secret origin of the band, the Birds?
Maybe.
I I'll be honest, from someone over this side of the pond, this seems very American because they're talking about their memorial battle against the British.
Well, a lot of them are dressed up in revolutionary costumes, too.
Exactly, yeah. There must be reenactments of societies.
So then we get the next one, which is also weird, where now this one is the early bird gets the worm. And Robin's like, well, maybe it could be me. That's usually a Robin, which I thought was intelligent of Robin to say. And it turns out that the penguin damages the Big Inch pipeline, which is also known as the Big Worm, and makes it so that oil goes so high up in the sky and splashes down on the payroll coming out of the pipeline building. Like, wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's an awful lot of work. I mean, Ozzy has been digging at that pipeline for quite some time.
Yeah.
Either that, and he's got one heck of a shovel. I love the fact it's got the big sign right beside it saying Big Inch Pipeline. Again, like the Batman TV series, everything is labeled. It's just what you want. It's superb. I mean, it's some form of mathematical genius that he must be in order to like hit the hole in the perfect spot right. So that the angle of this gushing geyser comes out so that it envelops the payroll building. Yeah. And of course, Penguin isn't affected because he always carries an umbrella. So he's not going to coat his oil. He can just run forward. Genius. Work to your strength, sir. That's what I say.
So then he lights the oil rainbow thing on fire. Which I thought was quite drastic.
Yeah, with a flamethrower umbrella. Fantastic. Again, as distractions go, it's a good one. Let's be honest. Yeah. And Batman and Robin obviously know that they should fight it with fire foam, but they don't have that. Instead, they use water, but they angle it in such a way that the water comes down on the flames and puts the flame part out. So
a little bit of science for the kids there.
And also saying, don't use water on oil, folks, but Batman and Robin know what they're doing, but don't you try it at home. Great fun.
Yep. So then Batman and Robin follow the penguin, who just throws the money away, and this is when they fall into the trap. The trap is simply they walk up and penguin's got a gun.
Yes, I mean, it could all end there, let's be honest. It's not even an umbrella gun, it's just
I know, that was disappointing.
And he marches them into his garage, because That's what you do. And they're tied up. And that's when he explains what we did in synopsis, that this stone bird is going to fly out and hit an electric eye, which will then cause them to explode, pretty much, setting off a bomb. Oh, dear.
And this is quite an escape. Batman and Robin are tied up with their arms behind them. For some reason, Batman carries a marble in his utility belt and paint and a little paintbrush. Okay.
This is wonderful. Of all the things to have in your utility belt, you don't have a knife. It's hilarious because Robin actually says, it doesn't contain anything with a sharp cutting edge, referring to Batman's utility belt.
Because we never get tied up.
And then Batman says, I know, but the marble, it saved us so many times before. It might help again. It's, as I said, it screams Adam West. It is amazing. And of course, the paint, they've got a full set of paints that he can then paint behind his back because it's Batman and that's what he does. But the paints are for their disguise, on-the-spot disguises that they do. Wonderful. Don't carry a knife, however, have a marble and a full set of paints for any particular disguise you need at any given time. I love this. Wholeheartedly, it's wonderful.
And he tosses the marble up to this window, which is, I don't know, 15 feet above. And the marble goes into the nest so that the bird thinks that's an egg, so that the bird won't leave at dawn and set off the explosion, which gives Batman and Robin time to, I don't know, wear down the ropes or something.
Yep, they can eventually escape. And they're free to capture the penguin, who then gets imprisoned. And as a lovely joke from the warden, again, running theme of wardens in this issue, they're painting his cell gold so that he's literally a bird in a gilded cage. Wah, wah, wah. Absolutely glorious. As I said, it's so Batman 66. It's wonderful.
Yeah, this is terrific. I really enjoyed this one a lot. I enjoyed all three stories in this book. No question about it.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Definitely me
great
too.
Great choice. I'm glad you chose it.
Oh, good. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
But before we wrap up, I do want to do a little creator history. This time of Bill Wolfolk, the writer of this last Batman and Penguin story. Most of it I got from Wikipedia. And there is also an issue of Tomorrow's Alter Ego number 158 from 2019 that was completely devoted to him. So links of all that stuff will be in the show notes. So I had seen his name on Golden Age Comics before, but I was pretty unfamiliar with his background. He was born in New York in 1917 and was the son of a theatrical manager and an actress. He began his career as an advertising copywriter from 1938 to 40, and then as a freelance writer for magazines from 1940 to 42 after graduating from New York University. Wolfolk was a friend of Seymour Wright, the creator of Casper the Friendly Ghost, okay, which I thought was really neat. Mm-hmm. He suggested that he write for the Eisner and Eager studio, which produced The Spirit and Black Hawk Comics, of course. The Eisner stable included some of the best artists of the time, Jack Cole, Lou Fine, Reed Carandall. Wolfolk worked in the comic book industry from 1941 to 1954, with time out for his military service. During this time, he wrote for most of the major publishers, including DC, where he wrote Superman and Batman. For Fawcett, he worked on Hangman, Captain Marvel, and others. And for Quality Comics, where he wrote Dollman, Plastic Man, and
The
Spirit. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. A cool note is that he is generally credited with creating Captain Marvel's "Holy moly" catchphrase. I thought that was fun.
Wow.
He rose in the business to become one of the most highly paid writers of comic books, earning $300 a week, which was 10 times the average salary. A humble quote directly from Wolfolk. Quote, "Writing during the so-called golden age of comics, I soon became the best paid and most sought after writer. There was little competition in the field. I wrote for all the characters now so nostalgically remembered. Captain Marvel, Superman, Batman, Captain Midnight, Black Hawk, Plastic Man, and many others. This work paid so well, was so easy to do, and was so much fun. But the golden age passed, and I moved on." In 1944, Wolfolk and Jack Oxton, who was an illustrator at Paramount Pictures, co-founded their own comic book company called OW Comics, which stood for Oxton and Wolfolk. They co-created the comic books Mad Hatter and Animal Fables. They intended for Mad Hatter to be published bi-monthly, but it only lasted 2 issues after the printing company they hired screwed up their order. I think that's fascinating. Instead of printing a regular 48-page comic book, the printing company produced a flimsy 32-page magazine, which required the comics pages to be eliminated from the finished stories, and the results were dreadful, both artistically and commercially. Eventually, MC Gaines bought out Animal Fables and turned it into a successful book, but OW Comics sadly folded pretty quickly. After leaving comics, Wolfolk became a periodical publisher in 1955, launching the monthly gossip magazine Inside Story. He eventually left periodical publishing for novel writing and to work in television. As a screenwriter, he primarily worked in the courtroom drama TV show The Defenders, where he was also a script editor. In 1964, he was nominated for a Writers Guild of America Award for The Defenders episode A Book for Burning. He also worked on the crime drama Arrest and Trial, which had an interesting premise. In the first half of each 90-minute episode, a detective investigated a crime, while in the second half, a member of the district attorney's staff tried the case. The series lasted only one season in 1963 to 64. I thought that was really interesting. You know, we got like procedurals nowadays, but you got like two in one.
Yeah. That's Law and Order before Law and Order. My goodness.
Wolfolk was also a prose writer. His first novel, The Naked Hunter, was published in 1953, but it was not until 1962 that he published his first hardcover book, My Name is Morgan. At the time of his death, his 19 works of fiction and nonfiction had sold over 6 million copies, and 8 had been selected by the Book of the Month Club. Yet he never became well-known in literary circles. Wolfolk, who sometimes wrote under pseudonyms, humorously attributed his anonymity to his remarkable versatility. Of interest to us, Wolfolk wrote 2 tie-in novels for TV based on the Batman 66 TV series, Batman versus the Three Villains of Doom, and Batman versus the Fearsome Foursome. Peter, do you have either of those? I have the Three Villains of Doom.
You mean these two bad boys, he says, holding them up for the benefit of your YouTube viewers.
Excellent.
Yes, although it's called Winston Lyon on the titles of both of these. So it's Winston Lyon, L-Y-O-N.
I'll have to actually go pull my copy down off the shelf.
I've had these for quite a while, but I've started reading through the Fearsome Foursome again. And I think this might be based on an earlier draft of the Batman movie because some of the names have changed and there's some scenes that don't quite happen the way they should. Like Commodore Schmidtlap from the movie, I think it's called Commander Redbeard, I think it is in this. And I've got one major bone to pick with him. And if you don't mind, can I read a little bit out from the book?
Of course, I love it.
We all remember this scene. Taking the bomb, Batman raced to the exit door. The bomb was sputtering from the fuse hole. Somewhere inside its infernal mechanism, the fuse was burning down to the final demolition point. No time to open the door, Batman crashed through it using his shoulder as a battering ram. Down he went to the tavern room below. He had hoped to find it empty at that time of day, but there was a crowd of disorderly roisterers. So at the head of the staircase, Batman looked down at the noisy mob. A thin wisp of smoke began to rise from the fuse hole of the bomb in his hand. He shouted, "Quick, everyone! Flee for your lives into the streets!" The command cut through the bedlam. One or two looked up at Batman at the head of the stairs, holding the huge, sputtering, smoking bomb in his grasp. The sight was enough to convince them. A girl shrieked. A sailor cursed. The crowd dashed pell-mell for the exits. Batman counted to 10. 10 precious seconds before he followed. Smoke began pouring from the bomb he carried. On the streets, Batman raced to the corner. The entire street seemed deserted. He lifted the bomb to hurl it away, and then, around the next corner, coming toward him, were several nuns. They were chatting and laughing gaily. Batman whirled to throw the bomb in the other direction. No better! A Salvation Army trio was on the curb beside their small stand for donations. They were puffing and playing away on their instruments. There could not be more than a few seconds left. A low whistle began inside the bomb. The whistle rose steadily in pitch. The bomb began to smoke furiously. There was an alleyway running narrowly between buildings that led toward the harbour. Batman plunged down it. If the bomb exploded here between buildings, at least there would be a minimum of damage. He sprinted out of the alleyway. The harbour, with a seawall guarding it, was directly ahead. He lifted his arm to throw the bomb. Now, if you're like me and you know that movie Inside Out, you know that scene has got ducks swimming by and Batman frustratedly looks at the camera and says, "There are some days you can't get rid of a bomb." And it's not in there. So I don't know if that was in an earlier draft of the script or if he thought, "No, I'm not writing that. That's just too silly." But I hugely remembered that first time I read that. I was very frustrated at that adaptation of it. But it's very interesting and great fun.
That's awesome. Thanks for doing that.
No, that's okay. Sorry to surprise you with that.
That was awesome. I loved it. I loved it. Finish it up on Bill Wolfe. He summed up his own writing career with a quote, "No literary monuments have ever been erected that proclaim he was versatile. No one looks forward to a new book by William Wolfe because no one, including the author, knows what it will be." Okay. He also claimed that his comic book work outshone his other literary production. Well, that's nice. According to Mike's Amazing World, Wolfolk is credited with 400 stories from 1941 to 54, including 129 for DC. He passed away in 2003 at the age of 86. So I had a pretty cool and interesting varied career. So thanks, everybody, for listening to me talk about him a little. Well, I think we are just about it. So, Peter, I ask everybody, did this comic live up to its special billing? What are your thoughts?
Oh, it certainly did. I mean, we both had an absolute riot reading all three of these stories. They are hugely entertaining, so much fun to be had. And again, at that time, you couldn't read the old stories unless right. you happened to come across a place that had old comics somewhere. And certainly over this side of the pond, that wasn't a thing. But yeah, so this is just an absolute gold mine at the time. We don't really think about it these days because you can basically read anything you like at any right. point, pretty much. But back then, this was like going down the mines and digging and coming up with a nugget. a gemstone of comic history. It's just wonderful. And yes, wanted. It certainly was when I saw it.
Excellent. No, I totally agree. This is a great comic book. A lot of fun to read it and get a chance to talk about it with you. So thank you. So Peter, can you tell everybody about your show and how they may be able to follow you on social media and so forth?
Yeah, sure. So the Earth 2 podcast, it's a weekly exploration of the DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics. What we really mean by that is we look at all the multiverse stories and through the power of dramatic reading and reenactment, we tell the stories and we then discuss them. Also do things like cover the contemporary correspondence at the time, looking at the letters pages. One of the things we love most is when you have future comic pros slagging off stories in the letter columns. It's hilarious. So that's always good fun. Occasionally we do proper full cast audio dramas. Paul helped me out with one recently. He was a fantastic man on radio announcing the baseball scores, I think it was. And the episode, that's the Silver Ghost episode, if you want to check that out back in the feed. But yes, my co-host David and I have been going for, coming up for 300 episodes. It might actually be 300 by the time this goes out, I think. Hi, David, if you're listening. 300 episodes and we're only in 1976. Got a long way to go.
Yeah, if you haven't heard the Earth 2 podcast, got my highest recommendation. Please go listen to an episode right now. Peter and David have an awesome, awesome show. So thank you again, Peter. So I'm going to play a short promo or two. And when I return, it will be time for the inaugural segment of Catch You Later Calculator with my bat brother, Sean M. Myers. Plus, I'll have our next episode announcement and listener feedback. So stay tuned.
Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2. In 1961, in the pages of issue 123 of The Flash, Barry Allen, the Silver Age Flash of Earth 1, travelled to another dimension, met Jay Garrick, the Golden Age Flash of Earth 2, and the DC Multiverse as we know it was born.
And in 1985, after many years of cross-dimensional adventures, DC Comics published the cataclysmic Crisis on Infinite Earths, and the DC Multiverse was gone.
But did you know that Barry Allen's Flash was not the first hero to meet a version of himself from another dimension?
Did you know that Jay Garrick wasn't even the first Golden Age character to return in the Silver Age of comics?
The scope of the pre-crisis DC Multiverse reaches far beyond Earth 1 and Earth 2.
And the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters is a lot wider than the heroes you know, like Flash, Green Lantern, Sandman and Starman.
On the Earth 2 podcast, we navigate the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse of universes and other dimensions.
And we celebrate and explore the legacy of DC's Golden Age characters, including the legendary Justice Society of America, and a lot more besides.
So join me, Peter Watson.
And me, David Steele, and our occasional guests of friends, family and fellow podcasters.
For weekly dramatic readings and analysis of the pre-crisis DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and Bronze Ages of comics.
On
the Earth 2 podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
Welcome back. It's now time for a special conversation with my Bat brother, Sean M. Myers. Before we start our coverage of the Daily Planet in May, we will be reviewing Bob Rozakis' epic 1976 storyline from the back pages of Detective Comics, number 463 through 468, in a limited series segment that we are calling...
Catch you later, calculator.
All right. So this is our first episode, Sean. Did you have all these issues when you were a kid? Tell me your history of the calculator epic.
I had none of these issues, and I don't have these issues now. So the good thing is they're all on DC Universe Infinite app, yep. Which is how I read them. Technically, this isn't my first time at the rodeo. I know I have read them before, and I guess you're the person who told me about these.
I think backups. Probably.
I'm almost positive. So then I looked at them, and I thought, oh, this is neat. It's a cool storyline, that kind of thing. And so that's how all of this happened. But yeah, I did not read it at the time. I did not read it probably for, I guess, 20 or 30 years after it was, and I don't have them. And it's funny because I thought, well, should I buy the issues? I'm like, well, no, behind the scenes, I have a trip to Universal coming up and I need to save for that. So I'm paying for DC Universe Infinite. So this
will use it.
Yeah. Way to, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I did have them. So these are the original copies that I had paid my 30 cents for in 1976. I just thought this was the coolest thing. Just to give you some context, listeners, this is right before the Steve Englehart, Marshall Rogers run of Detective that we talked about a little bit on Batman Family Reunion. And when we get to it in a couple months, the first published art of Marshall Rogers. And he got his start on these calculator backups because he did, I guess, a good enough job on the first two that he did. That's how he got to pencil the last issue of this, which is all these heroes teaming up with Batman. And that led to his gig working with Steve Englehart after, you know, Walt Simonson was on the first couple with Englehart, but then Marshall Rogers came in. So anyway, we can get to that when we get to Marshall Rogers. But I did have these issues. Batman was my favorite. And if I saw Batman or Detective Comics, I snapped them up. You know, I loved Justice League, which is my favorite group book, of course. And it was like the whole Justice League in the back of this story. And then when I found out the whole thing was going to be end and they're going to team up with that, I was like, oh, this is just a really cool. And I think it would be a great little, it wouldn't even have to be a little trade paperback. It'd be like an issue. There's 5 6 pagers. So that's 30 pages and seven. This would be 47 pages. Put that in a double sized issue. You could put one comic book out with this whole storyline in it and it'd be great. I did reread it a number of years ago. As sort of comfort food right at the beginning of COVID. It doesn't quite, we'll point out a lot of the crazy stuff that happens, but it is pure Bob Rozakis gold. It doesn't hold up like a modern epic might from a logic perspective, but it's way more fun. And it has great art too. You got two issues of Mike Grell,
yeah.
Got an Ernie Chua, and then three of Marshall Rogers. It's got a lot of great stuff going for it.
This month's hero is the Tiny Titan, Ray Palmer, the Atom. Let's get into it. This is from Detective Comics number 463, cover dated September 1976. The on sale date was June 29th, 1976. The editor was Julius Schwartz. And yes, you can read this entire story arc on the DC Universe Infinite app.
We should mention that the cover, it's the first appearance of the Black Spider. It's an Ernie Chua cover kicking Batman down off a building. But we do get a little image of the Atom on the front. It says, "Extra, the Atom fights crimes by calculation." And it's in the cigar band trade dress, the line of DC Superstars at the top. And it's got the Atom in the pose where his arms are out and the Atom symbol is swirling around him. I think it's Gil Kane. I'm not positive. It's not always on the cover, which is a shame. But this issue it is. And we'll mention them as time goes on.
The writer was Bob Razakis. The penciler is Mike Grell. Inker is, of course, Terry Austin. And the title is Crimes by Calculation. And this is 6 pages. Physicist Ray Palmer is attending Ivy University lecture given by one of his colleagues, Rick Bagley. Bagley is talking about earthquakes and how his invention, the aptly named Quake Breaker, can help channel the destructive energy of a quake into constructive use. After Bagley has droned on for a couple hours, Ray is bored and looking for some action, and he gets it. Of course, the earth starts quaking, but this is no ordinary earthquake. It is the first sighting of the Calculator. Since we're going to be talking about him for a few months, let's pause a moment to describe the Calculator's costume. Okay, listeners, I'm letting you in on a secret. Paul wrote this synopsis, and I can tell you, based on what he wrote, he likes the Calculator's costume a lot more than I did. Because what I'm going to read is what I edited, because he was praising Calculator's costume to high heaven. And I'm sure we'll talk about that, but let's go on with it. It is purple with white boots and white accents up the side. He has a white backpack and a chest plate that is a keyboard. At the top of his cowl on his forehead, there is a rectangular LCD screen that reads out helpful text and can emit energy blasts and other things at our heroes. Fantastic.
That was my word.
This part I did keep in because this is Paul 100%. The only thing that would be better is if he wore shorts.
I put that in for you.
He knew I was going to be reading this, and that part is absolutely true. I did not change that part. Back to the action. The Calculator states that he is there to kill Bagley before his invention is perfected. The Atom clobbers him on the chin, but the Calculator has calculated that the Atom would be there. His LCD blasts out rings of fire that encircle the Atom. Bagley flees for his life with the invention as the Atom dives into a water pitcher to put out the flames. Calculator chases Bagley outside while the Atom pursues him. When Ray catches up, the Calculator's LCD now blasts out a little hand, kind of like a Green Lantern construct, but pink, and pokes Atom's size and weight controls on his belt. The Atom's powers are out of whack, and he grows bigger, but lighter. The Calculator grabs him and throws him right at a brick wall. Despite his belt controls being messed up, we know that Ray has backup controls in his gauntlets. He is able to shrink fast enough that he passes right through the molecules of the wall. Before he can get back to Bagley, another quake rocks the university and creates a giant crevice in the ground. Bagley falls into the crack, and the Calculator seals it back up, killing him. As the Calculator cackles away at his success, the Atom rages at him. He punches him out, but just before he is completely defeated, the Calculator presses a special button on his chest plate. Despite sitting in jail at the end, he is laughing maniacally and thinks, "Project Atom is complete. Now for my next victim, the Black Canary." The end for now.
So let's talk about the art first and then the costume. Tell me what you think about the art, not counting the costume. You got Mike Grell, right? He's doing Green Lantern, Green Arrow right now, and probably don't know exactly when the Warlord starts because I think he gets busy after this, which is why he only does the first two stories.
Well, far and away, the art is the absolute best thing about this story, which we'll get into that. Oh my God, it is Mike Grell. And Mike Grell is just so good. There's lots of different, I don't know if I want to say lots of different kinds of action, but it's presented in a lot of different ways in terms of like camera angles and things like that. One part you're like down in the grass, the other part you literally see him going through the wall. I mean, no surprise that Mike Grell has great artwork, but it's just fantastic. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I like the beginning lecture hall. Things are crashing around, chairs are falling, guys are falling onto the ground, and then the Calculator comes jumping in through the wall. Very cool. You get a lot of great facial expression, and the Calculator just looks very straight up mustache twirling evil kind of guy, right?
Yeah.
Which is fabulous. His powers, I've reread this several times now since we started planning for this. Even now, it's impossible to figure out, is he causing the earthquakes? Or did he just calculate that there would be two earthquakes? We don't really know. Where does he get this crazy outfit with the stuff that comes out of his forehead? Never addressed. We never get the secret origin of the calculator by Bob. It's just like some of those stories we read in the Batman Family. Here's the action. Here's what's happening. Go at it.
So listeners, Calcia fans, Calcia cousins, whatever your name is going to be, I'm going to talk smack about this a lot, but I want you to know, I like these stories a lot. Now, the art is the saving grace, but Calculator is a villain kind of just because he says stuff. And spoiler alert, I looked up his Who's Who entry because I'm like, huh, I wonder if they ever talk about this. No, they never do. It's like, I can do this because it kind of relates to calculation. I will say he's 10,000% better than the Signal Man. You know I love a theme, so I'm going to go for Calculator every time over Signal Man. Well, okay, I just think we should pause a moment to talk about the costume.
All right, go ahead. Lay it on me what your thoughts on the costume are.
Now, to some degree, I kind of like the idea of the costume. He has this, I guess, chest plate that has a calculator on. Also, because I've read these stories again and again and again in preparation for this, the calculator itself is weird because the numbers go like in the left-hand column, 1, 2, 3, up to down. I don't even know.
Top to bottom.
It doesn't go across. My complaint about calculators and keyboards like that is some keyboards, the 1, 2, 3 start at the bottom. And sometimes the 1, 2, 3 goes at the top. Like, that's my complaint. But I've never had a calculator where 1, 2, and 3 are the very leftmost justified. And then, like, 4, 5, and 6 would be in the middle. And then 7, 8, 9 over on the right-hand side. So I think that's super odd. So obviously he's the calculator, not the keyboardist. Like, imagine Supergirl's headband, but a little bit more on top of her head. 3D, so like stuff comes out of it and it says words. I just can't help but think it'd be better if his calculator or like a keyboard would be on his arms. So he could type instead of having to press these buttons on his chest. It looks like he really likes himself because like, he's tapping on his chest. The visor should be on his chest where like stuff comes out of his chest. And then he could be typing on his arm. Now, those are the things I don't like. I do like the color because it's that dark purple.
Yeah, color is good. Yeah, I agree.
The white boots look great. There are like these things on the side. And I don't know. I guess they're just fabric, but they're like squares or rectangles. And they go all the way on the side of his legs, his belt. And then they're what goes down like his arm.
I think about this. It's 1976. All right. And calculators are like a new thing.
Yes. Yes.
Right. Bob, he's just got a calculator for the first time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, wow, what a great invention this is. I don't have to add things up by hand. Sitting in the production room, DC bought him a calculator. He's like, I'm going to make a villain. But what can the calculator do? It calculates.
Now, one thing I super appreciate is I don't think that there's any math in it. So I like that part.
All the math is behind the scenes.
Because I hate math. So I don't think they talk about numbers at all.
There's a couple things I love about this. The action is great because when the Atom, he jumps and then he changes, even though the momentum in the real world doesn't work like this, this is comic book physics, right? The Atom changes weight halfway through and he's able to slam into somebody at his full weight, even though he's 6 inches tall. So that's always a good thing, right? We always like the Atom doing that. But then first thing he does, the calculator spits out the ring of fire and it goes around the Atom. How does he put the fire out? He jumps into a water pitcher. I loved it.
That is neat. That's cool.
Because that would be there at a lecture, right? The lecturer at the front has a glass and a pitcher of water. And we've been told this guy's been going on for 2 hours about earthquakes and Ray Palmer's board. And this is another thing, the motivations of the calculator. Let's talk about that. So he says, I want to kill you at the time your life is most valuable. And that's the day before you perfect your invention. I don't get that at all.
It would make more sense once he has the invention, because that's when he would be the most valuable.
He wants to destroy the invention as well. Like I said, he's evil because he's evil. On the top of the second page, he says, observe as I calculate the answers. Boop, 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 boop. When is your life most valuable, Richard Bagley? Boop, 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 boop. And the top of his headband says, today. Does he do it for money? No. As a kid, I'm like, wow, what's going on? Surely they're going to answer all these questions. And surely we're going to figure this out as time goes by, right? Spoiler alert, not much.
Bob Rozakis is the answer man, but he did not have the answers to this.
He says he calculates things, and we'll see next month. We talk about the Black Canary. Another strange thing happens that will, did he calculate or did he cause? And the odds of some of the things happening, like an earthquake in Ivytown, which is, you know, on the East Coast, probably Providence, Rhode Island kind of thing, yeah. Right? They don't have earthquakes. They let alone two in a row with giant crevices. That's okay. The earthquakes happen. Maybe Quakemaster has taken a class there and rolled over on his quake machine and set it off by accident. Now let's talk about the death of Mr. Bagley. That's grim, right?
It's kind of horrible, actually.
It's hardcore.
Especially for like an 8-page backup in 76.
His invention falls into the crevice because he's running away from the calculator while the atom is battling the calculator. His invention falls into the crevice. He's reaching down to try to reach it, and he slips and falls into it, and then the calculator just closes it up and smushes the guy. Man. Wow.
I think you seem to think more he is causing it.
Yeah, no, that's true.
But he constantly says, just as I calculated, an earthquake has been my accomplice. Now, of course, how does he calculate all this stuff? Like, it's one thing if he was a geologist, theoretically, or had, like, access to this kind of information. He just, like, calculates that stuff is going to happen, which beats a signal. That might be my catchphrase through this. Beats a signal.
Yeah, then we get to the last page, and the atom is mad. I mean, it's good, real good art on this page. Middle of the page, you see the atom. I mean, this is his friend. His friend just got smushed by an earthquake. So he gives the calculator a kick and a punch on the jaw, and calculator goes down, but he hits his special button first before he's unconscious. So that will come back, listeners. We're not going to address the special button yet, but that will come back.
One thing they're talking about is with you and listening to you and looking at the pictures and everything. I have no doubt that this was meant for Detective Comics. But really, it feels more like Action Comics. Mm. Like, if you really look at this story, this is an action backstory. And granted, it's like a 6-page. But you have the room is quaking and he jumps through the hole in the first page. The second page, right in the middle, Adam is smacking calculator on the chin. The next page, Adam dives into the water. Midway through, he almost does a football tackle.
Yep, a clip.
Is that right, Brett? I think so.
If you tackle somebody from behind in the knees, that's a penalty. And he says, you know, that's a clip. It's good football knowledge by Bob Rozakis there.
He uses his like pink Green Lantern hand to shift Adam's weight controls. The next page, he throws him. Adam goes through a wall. You have a super cool down on the grass point of view of Adam running towards him. Literally every page. So like the next page is when the earthquake happens. Rick falls in and gets closed up. The last page, Adam knocks calculator in the waist and then the chin, he's beaten on him. This is action back. That's one of the things why I do like this story. And it's all because, and the art and
the art is fantastic.
I'm not a violent person, but man, there's a lot of hitting and punching and stuff. Like it makes for an exciting story.
Yeah, no, it's definitely exciting. Like many of Bob's masterpieces we talked about, if you don't think about it too hard, it's a lot of fun. And I think that's the point of what we're trying to do with this little mini series. Bring some appreciation for it. If half of you guys who are listening go and read this story and enjoy it, then our work is done. This is super fun. It's crazy. Things happen because they happen. And the art throughout the whole thing is fantastic. It's worth reading just for all those things I just mentioned. So
before we go, I have a question for Paul. Well, actually, I'm sorry. Let me say one more thing before I do my question, because I do want to say something good. The calculator's logo, I love. Because it's that 70s computer type, computer font. Some of the letters have the wide part of it and then the thin part of it. I love that. So I think that looks great. Okay, so Paul, I have a question for you. What is the calculator's real name?
Well, we don't find it out here.
Okay.
As Bob is
bye, calculator listeners.
Listen, the post-crisis calculator that most people know from like Birds of Prey, Noah, I've forgotten his last name, is a much better, more sophisticated, interesting, layered person. This calculator is not that. Probably the same guy, Noah, but how he gets all his equipment and how he calculates and all that stuff, no idea.
Noah. Yeah, maybe it is Noah. Noah, no idea how this happens.
All right. Whew. Final thoughts?
Again, and I kind of feel I have to reiterate that. And maybe I'll be saying this every episode. Anything we say negative about this, this is definitely worth reading it. Actually, I think I would say I love these issues, if only because of the art and the action. I think Calculator could be a super cool villain. It's just not presented here up to my satisfaction. But you know, going into it, you know this is a multi-part story. So you're thinking, oh, okay, well, somewhere along the line, we'll find out.
We'll see. That's it for Catch You Later Calculator this month. Next month, we're going to cover two issues, number 464 and 465, starring the Black Canary and the Elongated Man. So Sean's going to head back to the Batcave and rest up after this experience. But I still have my next episode announcement and listener feedback coming up. All right. Thanks, Sean. I'll talk to you next month. Listeners, please let me know what you think about Catch You Later Calculator. Before we get to the feedback, I do have a couple things I want to talk about. If you're listening to this, you probably know that right when we dropped last month's episode, our bat nephew Isamu Hideki Yukinori sent me a fantastic Daily Planet mock-up announcing the monthly planet segment, among plenty of other goodies. If you have not seen it, please go back to the special post I made in this feed or look on social media. It was a very special gift, and Sean and I both loved it, and I just wanted to make sure that I thanked Isamu on air. I also want to encourage you to check out this month's gallery, even if you don't normally. As I briefly mentioned earlier in this episode, Peter did send me some photos from the Forbidden Planet store in Glasgow, which has murals and art by Frank Quitely in it. It's really cool, so check it out. Now we have our next episode announcement. In February, I'm going to celebrate another holiday, Valentine's Day, and to help me do that, Fire and Water All-Star Siskoid will be here. We will be talking about Super DC Giant S-21, Love 1971. This is a really cool book, and I can't wait to talk about it. Plus, we will have the next segment of Catch You Later Calculator with Sean M. Myers. So look for that one on Sunday, February 1st. Now let's get to your comments about our holiday spectacular episode with Sean and the rest of the Fire and Water All-Stars. As always, please leave comments on the show posts on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. First, I do want to acknowledge Sphinx Magoo. Last month, he touted Bat Cousin Bob Rozakis' Secret History of All-American Comics. I did order that book, and it just came a couple days ago. I haven't read it yet, but I am looking forward to doing so. So thanks, Sphinx, for the recommendation. Next up, my pal, the Marvel Zombie Dan, says, "The amount of knowledge you guys have on DC is unreal. So great episode." Thank you, Dan. "I noticed something about the very first page. The heads at the bottom seem to be lifted from other sources and not the artists within this issue. For example, the Rock looked exactly like a Kubert to me, and the Jonah head looks to be from the primary artist of his series. And Superboy seems to be throwback from somewhere else too. Looks like the piece of art was added by the editor to get characters on that page and stop the first page from looking like a Classics Illustrated. That's very possible, Dan. I had assumed that the artist on that page, Gary Talawak, had been aping those styles, but they very well could have been statted in." And back to Dan. "And by the way, I do have that Superboy Spectacular you mentioned. At least I think it's the one. It's a one-shot. I got it because I figured it might be the subject of a special cast coming up." That's cool. Next time I come up there, I'll have to see that issue. Batnephew Isamu jumped in right away to remind us of something. "At the risk of having a blackened stocking, the subscription advertisements for the following DC Dollar comics, Detective, GI Combat, Superman Family, and World's Finest, are already on the Batman Family Reunion number 490 supplemental page." And he added a link, of course. So I am sorry, Isamu. I can't believe that neither Sean or I thought to mention that or remembered that when we were recording. So that was awesome and super fun. And I guess that's what you have to look forward to as you get as old like us guys. Next up, Super Captain said, "Paul and Sean, you guys make a great podcasting team, and it was great to hear all the other network all-stars on this holiday special." Thanks, Super Captain. "I never had this particular issue, but I did have the Legion story in the Best of Digest that Sean mentioned. I also have it in the Batman story collected in the DC Universe Christmas trade paperback from 2000. That's a great book. I have that one too. Both are fun tales, and the Legion one is right up there with some of the best Christmas comic book stories ever. As someone who's a person of faith, I wholeheartedly agree with Sean's praise for it, which tells me that Levitz, JLGL, and Dick Giordano got it right. As an aside, in my opinion, this year's DC Holiday Special entitled I Saw Ma Hunkle Kissing Santa Claus is a very strong effort, with stories featuring Ma Hunkle, Captain Ma, I can't bring myself to call him the Captain, Animal Man, the Atom, Ray Palmer, and Dr. Light, the female version, Supergirl and Martian Manhunter as the standouts. Thanks for the recommendation, Super Captain." Chuck Dill chimed in and agreed with that. "Based on your recommendations, I actually went out and purchased it myself, and I just finished reading it the other day and really enjoyed it. Glad to hear that the dynamic duo of Ken and Myers will be returning in 2026. And catch you later, calculator, sounds great to me. Merry Christmas and happy holidays. Same to you, Super Captain. Thanks for writing in. Ido Bosnar said, wow, a very special episode of Special Cast. And not like those very disturbing, very special episodes of sitcoms back in the late 70s, early 80s, in which creepy adults make passes at children or someone ruins their life by smoking one of those gas marijuana cigarettes, which I believe the kids are calling joints these days. Seriously, though, I commend you on putting together a really fun show, Paul. Thanks, Ido. Somehow, even though 1979 was possibly my favorite year for comics ever, and I was picking them up left and right, this one slipped past me. So the only story in it that I've read is the one with the Legion, as about a year later, as Super Captain above mentions, I picked up the best of DC Digest that included it. But what a story it is. While I wouldn't go so far as to say it's my favorite ever, I could see why someone would say that. It's a thoroughly enjoyable Christmas story, and my lord, the art is simply fantastic. In conclusion, great show, Paul, and darn near every single other FNW host. Hope you all enjoy the holidays. Thanks, Ido. I hope you had a great holiday season, too. Next up, past guest, Dr. Ange, said, I definitely brought this off the spinner rack and had it in my youth, but it was lost in some parental purge along the way. Some of these stories are just great. I mean, nothing says Christmas like slinging the two dead bodies of some ornery galoots over a horse. But the Legion one is the one I knew best. I think this is the one where we learned Colossal Boy was Jewish, making a new element to his character. And I do think this one goes for a prettier penny than most of these holiday anthologies because of the whole first Frank Miller Batman-ness of it all. Great show all around with a great cast of podcasters. Happy holidays. Thanks, Ange. Right back at ya. Fire and Water All-Star and one of the guests on the Holiday Spectacular, Chris Franklin, writes in to say, wonderful episode, Paul. It was a pleasure to join in on such a fun episode, but I really enjoyed hearing everyone else discuss the stories with you. This is a really strong special, and I don't think there's a dud in the bunch, and certainly not a dud amongst the co-hosts. It was particularly great to hear you and Sean together again, and I'm really looking forward to Catch You Later, Calculator, great title, Sean, and the Monthly Planet feature coming next year. Thanks, Chris. Next up, Lizanne Oswald. Impressive podcast, most impressive. And Merry Christmas. Oh, wow, Sean is back. I almost want to break into the Sean Tiff's pack. Sorry, Lizanne, I don't know that one, but Sean probably does. Cool cover. I like the composition that has the heroes lead your eye right to the title. Only in comics can a normal man like Jonah get shot in the chest and shake it off. Anyway, glad he helped the kid. Geez, Bruce, you got abs of steel? I've seen boxers take some shots, but never where they broke a man's hands. Anyway, the suits are all 70s, cool, no complaints. I know, shocking. But on the other hand, Kane, not only did you kill your brother, but you also committed crimes of fashion with a green jacket and an orange shirt. The Legion story is fine. I guess I'm glad they remembered Colossal Boy was Jewish. The story had no Cosmic Boy? That's just wrong. Was Comet Queen a member yet? If so, then she should have been there too. Anyway, cool comic. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and all the other holiday celebrations to all, and I can't wait for the next podcast. Lizanne also came back later to add a link to a Tiffany song she thought would fit the return of Sean. So check out the website. So thanks, Lizanne. Bucky749 said, a wonderful episode. Thanks, Bucky. He then asks, do you have any Christmas TV episodes you watch every year? What's your favorite Christmas special? Mine is the United Wrestling Federation 1986 Christmas episode and Santa Claus Has Come to Town. Well, Bucky, I can't argue with Santa Claus Has Come to Town, and my wife makes me watch It's a Wonderful Life every year, and every year I cry at the end. Next up, Bat DJ Matthew Davis says, great episode, guys, and Paul, glad to see you made it across the Eastern Seaboard in record time. Did NORAD escort you like they do Santa? Well, Matthew, you know, I don't like to brag, but, you know, back to Matthew. He said, this was one of my favorite holiday issues and one of the best. Not a bad story in the bunch. Like many of us, I did get certain special books for Christmas. The Batman and Superman from the 30s to the 70s, the Superhero Encyclopedia Volume, and the big Secret Origins of DC Superheroes. That last one I know I still have and may be what led to my love of the JSA with all the Golden Age origins. A great book, Matthew. It was fun to hear the Batman family reunion, if I may share a few favorite versions of various Christmas carols. The Little Drummer Boy / Peace on Earth by Bing Crosby and David Bowie. Glam rocker and straight-laced crooner, yet their voices melded together so well in this song. I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus by John Cooper Mellencamp. Took a cute novelty song and rocked it. Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer by Postmodern Jukebox. I love the retro spin they put on songs. Happy holidays to all, and looking forward to more episodes like this in 2026. Paul, do you have any specials from the Bicentennial lined up for the Sesquicentennial? Well, I'm not sure about that last point, Matthew. I'd have to think about what issue would really be appropriate. And listeners, if you have any ideas, let me know. The only two issues that carry the DC Comics Salute the Bicentennial banner that fall into DC Special Cast remit are DC Superstars number 5, starring The Flash, and Four Star Spectacular number 3. I'm not sure either one of those is on my radar right away, but willing to think about it. So you give me some food for thought, Matthew, so thanks. Brian Schufo says, another fine episode with a lot of great guest hosts. Pulling this off must have been a logistical nightmare. Well, it was a challenge, Brian, but I think it was worth it. I had a lot of fun and racked up some frequent flyer miles. Good to hear you and Sean together again. In my home growing up, it was always stockings first on Christmas morning. We were allowed to go through the stockings while our parents slept a little longer. It was also the time of the Lifesavers holiday book, which had a disturbing number of Lifesavers rolls that no kid should ever have all at once. Sean, I hope you complete your run of the New Adventures of Superboy soon. Keep an eye out for my one and only letter printed in one of those letters pages. I've never gone back through my collection to look for it because, one, the ramblings of a 12-year-old self would be embarrassing, and two, my name was misspelled as Kyuto with a T because it was a handwritten letter, and my penmanship was always a C-. Thanks, Brian. Next up, past guest and good friend of the network, Martin Gray, says, what a special treat, Paul, you visiting all the relatives for Christmas. But why was Shag on the outs? Is he the little podcaster that Santa Paul forgot? Oh, don't get me started, Martin. I heard enough about it in Baltimore. Don't worry, everybody. We will have Shag on in 2026, I promise. Paul, you and Brett were talking about Jeff Parker's DC Santa Claus Christmas special with all the heroes and said there was going to be another one this year. Well, actually, the first one came out 2 years ago and the sequel was last year. Maybe you were recording this last year? No, we recorded this fall, Martin. But Brett responded, you're right on the timing. The years were blending together. As for me, I was thinking of the trade paperback, Martin, which I just received the sequel trade paperback. So thank you for keeping us on the straight and narrow, though, Martin. Back to Martin, he said, anyway, what else can I say about the comic? It's a classic and everyone agrees. Oh, for the days when DC would fill a comic with stories by proven talent. Thanks, Martin. Chuck Dill is next up, and he said, wonderful episode as always. I picked this up in the late 1980s as part of my hunt for all Legion material I could find. I do so love that Legion story. I remember the first time I read it and skipped all the stories that didn't feature superheroes. Not so on subsequent rereads. I've always loved Christmas comics, and I even have a spreadsheet I add to whenever I find the appearance of Christmas in a comic book story. In back-to-back Christmas mornings, I found the DC Christmas treasuries poking out of the top of my stocking. Wonderful memories. Well, Chuck, as an actuary and fellow math nerd, I love it when I hear about comic spreadsheets. You should see the one I have for my collection. Next up, past guest, Fire and Water All-Star, and host of the great show Peacebound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, Sean Ross says, great episode, Paul and gang. I love getting to hear Paul and Sean, even if he misspells his name together. So joyous. The mention of how often Denny went back to the well and the stars saving the day in Batman Christmas stories cracked me up. Reminds me of the Saturday Night Live gag about A Christmas Carol. Scrooge is visited by three ghosts, Dickens. I guess Tiny Tim is the only one who needed a crutch.
And here's one from Nate the Great, who says, this one is probably best remembered for the Frank Miller Batman story, but reading it years later, it really gets upstaged by the Legion story and the surprise appearance of the Phantom Stranger. Was Superboy being a bad guest? Yeah, but after all, he did get to kiss Phantom Girl, and he got to put a Christmas tree up. Surprise Wildfire didn't tell him off. Anyway, Merry Christmas. Thanks, Nate. Next up, Robert Smith, who says, Merry Christmas. This Legion story is my favorite Christmas superhero story of all time, and I'm not even really a Legion fan. In fact, as far as I'm concerned, the three greatest Christmas stories of all time are The Nativity, A Christmas Carol, and Starlight, Star Bright, Furthest Star I See Tonight. So, when are you doing the DC Giant Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas? Well, there's two of them, Robert, believe it or not. There's a DC Special number 16 that Martin has claimed for when his turn comes around again. But there is the one shot left that nobody's claimed. Not sure when we'll get to them, but, you know, there's a couple slots left in 2026. So if people are interested, send me an email, dcspecialcast@gmail.com. And finally, our good pal Captain Entropy says, it is totally appropriate and a terrific Christmas gift for the listeners to have a lineup of Network All-Stars for this issue themed around the Christmas star and the return of Sean Myers and the announcement for exciting new podcast segments. It's an embarrassment of Christmas riches. I bought this comic off the shelf and has loved it ever since, but it also confused me. The stories herein, especially the one with the exploding starship, taught me that the Christmas star appears every year at Christmas. It wasn't long before I learned that this is only true in the DC Universe. Astronomers have posited hypotheses about what the Star of Bethlehem might have been. They usually revolve around a comet or a planetary conjunction. No one but DC says it happens every year, though. Regarding Sean's mom putting an orange in the bottom of the stockings, as a participant in the Florida economy, I fully approve. Median income is a lot higher than it used to be, so I think back before our time, fruit in the Christmas stocking was widely considered a treat. Hey kids, enjoy this delicious way to prevent scurvy. In our family, we also start with stockings. For us, they are the gift appetizer, not the dessert. I remember the Jonah Hex tale fondly, and will reference it on a Fire and Water podcast coming soon. I was blessed to be raised by some terrific parents, but youngsters tend to take these sort of blessings for granted until they read about Jonah Hex's dad. I will quibble on one point. I know no one else cares about this semantic point, but it's a bugbear of mine. Jonah didn't murder the tall brothers. He killed them in self-defense. Fair point, Captain. I get what you're saying there. Cap goes on and says, I think the scarf around his hat keeps it on his head in the winter wind. I'm currently visiting a country that, unlike Florida, has a real winter, so it occurs to me that I hope the scarf is protecting his ears. Regardless, great coverage of a classic Christmas tale. I especially appreciate Brett's quick review of Jonah's origin. Regarding Frank Miller's first bat tale and the first appearance of fan favorite Marty Lascow, I mentioned that story on my upcoming guest appearance too. I kind of wish that episode had come out before this one. It would have worked as a preview for DC Special Cast. I noticed that poor villain markmanship is a Christmas present for the second story in a row. Finally, Paul and Chris, I really appreciated your analysis of Miller's early Batman art with all its influences. On the Horror Host Christmas Party segment, I always liked the jeweler pawnbroker story the best. Like the Jonah Hex story, it mashes up Christmas generosity and compassion with unrelenting retribution. What more could a comics fan ask for? Also, like Paul and Rob, I love word balloon logos, Cindy in her dress, and the Phantom Stranger's brief but influential appearance. It would be a real Christmas miracle if I didn't have a lot to say about the Sergeant Rock tale. The nun saying that the true shrines are in our hearts is 100% consistent with Christian scripture. The New Testament says in multiple places that individual believers in the church as a whole are temples indwelt by the Holy Spirit of God. Of course, that has implications about how we treat our bodies and what we do with them, so I'm happy I was listening to this while I was pursuing the redemptive power of physical therapy exercises. I really liked Ryan's points about how the parishioners force the soldiers to conform to the morality of non-combatants, whereas soldiers generally have to conform their morality to the realities of combat. It's a triumph of peace, refusing to yield to war. I think I've seen Rock reference his combat antenna before. It's the DC Comics term for high situational awareness combined with an intuition born of experience. It's definitely a thing among people who have spent time in combat or even dangerous places. The person experiencing it realizes the situation has changed or is somehow out of the norm before he can put his finger on how or why. Often it's when the environment gets abnormally quiet or when the locals are behaving differently than you expect. The people who live are the ones who trust their gut and react. To me, this was one more benefit of trustworthy, experienced local interpreters. Their combat antenna were typically outstanding. That's a great point. Thanks, Cap. That's really interesting. He keeps going. He says, you're right, Paul. I don't know as much about artillery as I do about airplanes. I do know that it is truly more blessed to give artillery rounds than to receive. I'll share some other scraps of data. The 88mm artillery piece was bigger than most of what we had in the inventory, and the Germans treated the gun like Pete's Red Hot. They put it on everything, including main battle tanks. It was certainly bigger than anything we had on a tank at this point in the war and would cut right through American tanks' armor. Standalone 88mm guns were certainly the kind of thing you wanted to get rid of before Patton's armored forces attempted to roll into town. Flak became the general word for barrage anti-aircraft artillery fire, 88s and other guns pointed up so that the rounds explode over, below, and worst of all, through Allied aircraft. Airmen hate flak, but because you inspired me to do 30 seconds of research, I now know that it did indeed start as an official name for the 88 anti-aircraft gun. It's a German acronym for Flieger, which means flyer, Abwehr, which means defense, and Cannon, which means cannon. Wow, that's really cool, Captain. Thanks for doing that research and sharing it with us. He goes on, Brian, I loved Band of Brothers, too. My daughters got me to watch one episode, and I was hooked. My eldest daughter, Miss Inertia, has gifted me with not only the Band of Brothers book by Ambrose, but also memoirs by members of Easy Company. I'm making my way through them. And by the way, Easy Company has a common name because the companies were named after the letters of the World War II phonetic alphabet, D for dog, E for easy. The post-war phonetic alphabet NATO uses is mostly different, so now those companies would be Delta and Echo. The worst art in this book was excellent. The art in the Legion story was about as good as comic art could get in 1979. I vividly remember Phantom Girl kissing Superboy under the mistletoe. I thought Superboy's response was perfect. In the gallery page for this episode, I noticed that Superboy had his arm around PG at the end of the story. Ultra Boy better watch out. This story initiated my juvenile crush on Phantom Girl. I'm sure I'll get over it if I ever achieve adulthood. People helping other people was a theme of these stories almost as much as the Star of Bethlehem. Like Sean, I'm pleased that the Legion of Tail expressed it so explicitly. Christ followers obviously don't have a monopoly on people helping other people. Almost all religions stress that principle, but it is a core tenet of the Christian faith, even if we Christians don't always act like it, so I love when it's associated with Christmas. Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, was the second greatest commandment in Scripture. When someone then asked who counted as a neighbor, he told the parable of the Good Samaritan, told his audience to behave like the Samaritan did. In the middle of his teaching about kindness, he struck a blow against racism by using someone from a hated minority as the role model for helping others. As both the Old and New Testaments repeatedly teach us to help the poor and disadvantaged, James even wrote that true religion was caring for widows and orphans and keeping oneself uncorrupted by the world. Regarding Sean's point that, quote, there's an outside existence bringing these people together, as a theist, of course, I agree wholeheartedly with that intuitive understanding of the universe. Sean also correctly said, helping people makes you feel good. There's an etymologist/biologist named E.O. Wilson, who studied why some animals, like ants, dolphins, and people, help others when there's no direct benefit to themselves or their offspring. He concluded there's a biological advantage to looking out not only for ourselves and those who carry our genes, but our entire species and even other species. So according to his theory, we are wired for empathy. When some people tried to use Wilson's work to argue there was no God, Wilson rebuked them. I think he was cagey about his own beliefs for much of his life, but said nothing in his theory precluded God also designing us to have empathy, maybe because it reflected his character. Anyway, like Sean said, I owe a lot to people who've helped me, and I appreciate the reminder to be grateful. I remember this as the issue that revealed Colossal Boy was Jewish. I think Hembeck even did a strip about Jim Allen going to Hebrew school now, because thanks to Paul Levitz, he had to learn Judaism. I was thrilled to see the practice of any specific faith in DC Comics. They usually shied away from that sort of thing, but I especially appreciated that Judaism was alive and well in the 30th century. The character development for Jim and the diversity for the Legion was our nice bonuses. Of course, I used fewer words when I was 7, so I'm pretty sure I just said, Colossal Boy's Jewish, cool. Superboy did come across as a small-town traditionalist getting grumpy at these futuristic beasts anyways. As a kid, I found that a little annoying. I was also a small-town traditionalist, but I was still much more impressed at the 30th century glitz than teen Clark was. I also wasn't sure he was being a good guest with his complaining. However, Paul, the points you make about how he's acting like a real teenager make me appreciate him and the writing a lot more. Well, 14 pages in my notes app probably covers it, unless I'm going to comment on the feedback too. Terrific work by every comic creator, guest, and the hosts involved. Thank you and Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Holidays. Whatever you celebrate, may this season in 2026 be happy for you and your loved ones. Well, thank you, Captain. Those were great notes. I appreciate it, and it's a great place to end our feedback.
That's it for the comments. Thank you again to everyone who wrote in. A reminder that if you are enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the cost. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. This episode's special thanks go out to our Sunday supporters, Al the Comics Guy, David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, and Mike Atchison. To find out more, go to patreon.com/FW podcast and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. Special thanks to Peter Watson for appearing on this episode. I'm serious. If you haven't listened to Earth 2 Podcast, go listen to it right now. It's a great show. Thanks for listening, everybody, and I hope you will join me and Siskoid next month as we contemplate Love 1971.